Hello, and welcome to episode 206 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, a former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 at Pearl Harbor, as well as many other assignments. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm doing great, Seth, and I'm really excited to talk about the guy who, more than anybody else, caused me to join the submarine force. It's going to be a great episode today.
It is. It is. Absolutely. And aside from Bill and I, those who are watching probably see him on the screen right now. We are very happy to have our new guest with us today. You probably heard or seen him at least on his YouTube channel. I'm very, very sure. He provides excellent in-depth doses of naval history, which is near and dear to Bill and I's heart here. And we are very glad to have him. We'd like to welcome Drakenfeld to our show. Drak, welcome aboard, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah,
I've seen so many of your videos and never seen what you look like. So that's a particular pleasure today.
You'll usually only find what I look like either on live streams or the occasional one where I actually go and visit a place. Most of the time, I'm the voice.
But a great voice, and a great voice for naval history. So glad to have you.
Absolutely. You've done quite a bit here in the last few years to propel the subject of naval history into more popular media than in the past.
Yeah.
And we're very appreciative of your efforts and getting our subject matter out there to the masses. Well, so again, we're going to start off this week. We're talking about a very important topic, a very important individual, a very important vessel, and we'll just jump right into it here. So, as the submarine Wahoo pushed through the waters of the Pacific upon completion of her fifth war patrol, headed for Mare Island in the United States, a message came through addressed to the executive officer of the boat. The young lieutenant commander opened the message and read it. The message contained news that all executive officers of any ship in the U.S. Navy hoped to hear at one time or another. Orders to the United States and new construction. Lieutenant Commander knew full well what that meant. He would get his own boat. Now he would be skipper. He would lead men into battle and hopefully bring them back alive. The news, while exciting, was also bittersweet. His orders meant that he would have to leave the boat that he helped build into, at that time, the deadliest submarine in the entire Pacific Fleet. And he would also have to leave his best friend, who happened to be the skipper of Wahoo, and the most famous submariner in the entire silent service. Nevertheless, orders were orders, and as such, soon after Wahoo arrived in San Francisco, Lieutenant Commander Dick O'Kane bid Wahoo and his best buddy Mush Morton adieu and walked off to take command of a new Baleo-class submarine fitting out at Mare Island. A few months later, O'Kane received word that his old boat Wahoo and his best friend Mush Morton had been lost. Already possessing an insatiable will to sink enemy shipping and help end the war, O'Kane now had a burning desire for revenge. That desire, passion, and professionalism that drove him aboard Wahoo would cement both he and his boat, USS Tang, as the most successful American submarine in history and give us one of the most courageous and inspiring stories of the entire war. So, gentlemen, I think the proper place to start this conversation is to talk about the guy that I just introduced, that of course being Lieutenant Commander, later Admiral, Richard O'Kane. He is probably the most, well, he's not probably, he is the most legendary skipper of the silent service, in my opinion. Let's talk about him. Who was he? Who was Dick O'Kane?
So Dick was a New Englander born in Dover, New Hampshire in 1911. He's born with the smell of salt air in his nose, as many New Englanders are. Sea chanties and all those things are still quite active up there. As a young man, he developed a knack for mechanical stuff, constantly tinkering with things, taking them apart, putting them back together. Now, he was very fiercely competitive all through his life and career. He once rigged a sailboat with a motor from a Maytag washing machine just so he could outpace others nearby. Finally educated at a prestigious prep school, which was unusual, let me say, for guys entering Annapolis, and bordering on genius, O'Kane secured an appointment to the academy in 1930 and graduated in 34. He spent his first years in the Navy in service, as did everyone in those days, aboard surface ships, the cruiser Chester and later the destroyer Pruitt. After his service aboard Pruitt, he requested and was granted submarine training and served aboard his first submarine, USS Argonaut, for nearly 4 years. By the way, Argonaut was a huge submarine, even by modern diesel submarine standards. It was designed for things that special things like mine laying. And so, and it was based out of Pearl Harbor. So even in his book, Dick O'Kane uses a Hawaiian word, kama'aina, which means somebody who's come to the island and become like their Hawaiian, even though they're not from Hawaii. And it's a wonderful experience he had living in Hawaii throughout all of his submarine tours. Now, I met Dick O'Kane at the Naval Academy. I had just found out my eyes went bad. I wasn't going to be a pilot, which means I wasn't going to be an astronaut, which was my ideal. And suddenly this dude shows up selling his book in 1978. And he signed the book for me and said, dude, Bill, you really need to go submarines. I mean, just read this book. It's the most exciting career you can possibly have. Submarines won the Pacific War, World War II. And submarines are going to be responsible for winning the Cold War. Don't you want to be part of that? And so he had me sold. He had me at hello, to use the expression. And really, that's the reason I went submarines. Drac, what do you know about Dick?
So most of my knowledge of him comes from kind of once he's joined the submarine service, especially because I've been working my way through the U.S. Navy's Pacific submarine campaign. And as you mentioned, you know, his service aboard Wahoo is part of the legend that is that ship or boat, I guess, it's considering it's a sub. And he seems to me, from what I've looked at, especially when in his time aboard Wahoo, he seems to have been kind of this sort of steady anchor that the rest of the crew rallied around. As well as being, as you suggested with his earlier life, something of a technical genius, especially with Morton's habit of assigning crew to the areas that they seemed to do best in, rather than what the book said, well, first officer goes here and so on and so forth. So as well as being obviously a very technically minded, I think the fact he was a slightly more stable element than Morton was, gave him a lot of respect from the crew to O'Kane. It's going to be quite interesting because this, the period now that we're getting into when he takes command of Tang, this is kind of the period I'm in the middle of doing a deep dive of research on for a follow-up video in that series. So a lot of what he's about to get going and doing is quite fresh, but also I think one of the most profound things that I've done while researching for the channel that hasn't involved talking to someone who was actually there was a video I discovered in the NARA archives. And it's actually a really high quality video. I mean, if you colorized it, you'd think someone had sat there with a high def camera these days. But it's actually of Wahoo coming in for what will turn out to be the last time.
Really?
And whoever the cameraman is just, yeah, it's coming in for the refit and, you know, O'Kane will now be transferred off. And there's all the crew and especially O'Kane as they bring her in. Yeah. And they're just, you know, unlike a lot of people who get in front of the camera in that time period, they're basically acting as if they're not even, the camera's not even there. In fact, it's questionable whether they even realized at that point, you know, just conducting general operations as they bring the boat alongside, chatting to each other, etc. And you get to see how the crew are operating as a unit, you know, as they would have done out at sea. And it was an incredibly profound thing for me on multiple accounts, because one, you just don't see that kind of footage very often. Right. Two, obviously, it's kind of, that's the last time I think probably Wahoo's crew as a whole was ever caught on film or in picture. But also you've got, you know, it's that also that kind of thing of, like you mentioned, O'Kane subsequently, you know, went on to have a fairly long career. But how many times when if you either know of, or in your case, Bill, get to meet the individuals later in life when they're considerably older, you can look back and go, oh, well, here's a nice black and white picture, or you know, here's a staged, you know, a medal recipient ceremony or something, or here's some really, really grainy footage that shows a blob that is apparently them. But then this time it was like, no, that's what they were. That's exactly who they were back then. And you could see, you know, it's one thing to read about the personalities, but when you actually just see them over about 20, 25 minutes of operations, you actually get to see those personalities going on. I swear at one point, Morton's just sort of all being sort of very happy and gesticulating and gesturing and being very rambunctious and energetic. And at one point, he then turns away to yell something down from the conning tower or the sail at someone on the dockside. And I swear you see O'Kane just roll his eyes slightly. before looking back.
O'Kane was putting up with him walking around in his bathrobe and underwear, so which was not O'Kane, so different in so many ways and so alike in others. And aside, quick aside, sorry, Seth, but of course we know that Wahoo was lost in Ulapu Strait north of Hokkaido. And as we're recording this just recently, it was discovered that the albacore was also lost. And we just recently discovered on the bottom north of Hokkaido. So that was a very dangerous bit of water that the Wahoo was lost in. And it turns out, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but of course, Tang was lost in a very different body of water, but no less dangerous. We'll just get to that. Yeah.
You know, you talk about O'Kane and anybody who served with him aboard Wahoo before Mush Morton came aboard. So when he was under the command of Pinky Kennedy as XO of Wahoo, and then later through his progression as, you know, under Morton, and then of course CEO of Tang, they said that he literally made a change overnight into the kind of man that he was to actually become. And that, and by that I mean, you know, George Grider, who later became a successful submarine skipper in his own right, he later after the war wrote a memoir, as a lot of sub skippers did, but he said that initially when O'Kane was under the command of Kennedy, he called O'Kane a petulant child, that he acted like a petulant child, that he would pull rank all the time on junior officers. Yeah. And he would just kind of act like an ass, and he didn't like him. Like, George Grider made no bones about it. He's like, I don't like this guy. You know, yeah, he's my senior officer, but he ain't cool. And then he said that once Morton came
in, I had an XO that I didn't like either, so I know what that's like.
But once Morton came aboard and they started to work together more, especially on that third patrol, when Morton made O'Kane his co-approach officer, when O'Kane's, you know, he's got his eyeballs on the scope, he said, George Grider said he watched O'Kane literally overnight transform from this petulant adolescent child to this incredibly calm, cool, efficient machine. I mean, literally overnight, you know, he just became this model submarine skipper. And even though he wasn't skipper at that time, he just became this ultimate fighting machine that he says it was absolutely amazing just to watch this. Because after that, like, O'Kane's behavior aboard the boat changed. You know, he wasn't pulling rank on people. He wasn't acting like a jerk. You know, he was just, he'd found his niche. He'd found what he was there, put on the planet Earth to do. And he realized that, and he honed that to such a razor sharp edge that, I mean, it's unbelievable what the man was able to do. And really, you know, Drac, you said, in a long career, and he did have a long career, but Tang's career really wasn't that long, and we'll get to it, but if you look at the time span, it really wasn't that long, and what he was able to do in that amount of time is mind-boggling. It really is. It's incredible. So, you know, as I said, he was known to act aloof with his junior officers, and you know, he just wasn't well liked. But when he took command of Tang, he took complete control of everything, and not to be like, he wasn't pedantic. He wasn't, you know, high and mighty or heavy handed, but he knew what he wanted out of that boat. He knew what he wanted it to be. And he made sure that every officer and enlisted man aboard that boat conformed to that regiment, conformed to that, you know, persona in his head, to help form this boat into such a highly efficient machine. You know, he was a stern commanding officer, but he was fair. You know, he wouldn't berate people. And if, you know, he'd correct them and he'd be like, all right, do this or don't do this or whatever the case may be. And that was it. You know, he didn't harp on people about it. He didn't bring it up over and over again like some other people have done. You know, he would just boom, boom, done, move on. And that was a huge, huge, huge thing for the crew and for everybody else that was involved, is that, you know, they knew that he had this highly experienced skipper, because, I mean, everybody in the subservice knew about Wahoo. They all knew who Mush Morton was. They knew that Dick O'Kane had been Mush Morton's executive officer. You know, so, I mean, they knew that they got a guy who's got some skins on the wall, and that means a lot. You know, that means a lot to those guys that, you know, he's going to take in the battle. So,
yes, example of that, Seth, you know, his XO on Tang, Lieutenant Murray Frazee, who he called Fraz for short, said that O'Kane was a hard charger, but never crossed line into recklessness. The more you got to know him, the more you realized that under the abrasive behavior exterior, he was a pleasant, patient, and generous man. He hated to lose at anything, which amused me. We shared a suite at the Royal Hawaiian, went to social events together. Our wives were friendly, and we went to dinner together often. He was abrupt at times and was not a diplomat. he had a commanding presence, but he was a maverick, an American original. And he commanded a Baleo class boat. Drac, can you tell us a little bit about what changed with the Baleo class submarine?
Yeah, so the US has obviously, in the late 20s and early 30s, they've been working their way up to what they've defined as a fleet submarine, which hilariously enough ends up never actually carrying out its intended function, because the idea of a fleet submarine actually goes back to World War One, when the term comes from the idea that the submarines are fast enough on the surface that they can stick with the battle fleet, and then when it comes to battle, they can submerge and, you know, go off and do submarine things, which back in the day led to all sorts of wonders, like the British K class, where that someone thought it was a good idea to put a steam, like a full-on steam turbine set in the sub. That worked about as well as you might expect. But the US had been working on this, as I said, during the interwar period. They'd begun to get some pretty decent success out of the idea. Firstly, by making the submarines larger than most people did, because you've got to get the range to get across the Pacific. Then when they realized that actually, to be perfectly honest, their marine diesels really sucked. And then someone went, hang on a minute, we have some diesel engines of about the correct power output that work really well on the railroads, and basically stole a bunch off of the railroads. And that worked perfectly well. And then you have the Gato class, which is kind of the pinnacle of US fleet sub design. It coming up to the start of World War II. Then you have the Baleos, which are their successors, which they don't change a huge amount in terms of size, layout, firepower, etc. But what they do become is a lot, lot tougher. I actually only recently found this out. The reasoning behind why they became tougher, I mean, it was a general design goal, but the idea specifically that was implemented actually came from the shipyards, because as you'll know, as a submariner, you know, ballast for the sub is very important when you're on the surface, unless you start wanting to go 360s. But in the Gatos, they had lead ballast along the keel to keep them the right way up. But once war broke out, every ounce of lead that was available was needed for the production of things like bullets and so forth, and it just seemed to be unnecessary dead weight. But if you took it away, then a submarine of that design became dangerously unstable and had too much buoyancy. And so some genius in the shipyard just went, well, why don't we just make the pressure hull out of thicker steel? And that, you know, steel, relatively speaking, was cheap. They were making the hull anyway. And by making the hull thicker, it would add to the overall displacement of the sub, which then meant it would sit correctly in the water. And you didn't have this dead weight underneath. And it also became a stronger pressure hull, so it could dive deeper, which also would, at shallower depths, it would marginally reduce the effectiveness of enemy depth charges and so forth, which was quite useful if you're under attack. But also, if you went very deep, as it turns out that the Baleo and the subsequent Tench classes were capable of doing relative to the sort of 200-250 foot operating depth of a lot of pre-war subs, if you went as far down as they were capable of, you could actually become pretty much immune to depth charges, because the depth charge effect, although it's much worse news if you're down at 400 feet and you spring a leak than if you're at 50, the pressure of the water contains the explosive effect of the depth charge somewhat more, so they have to get closer to you. But also, Japanese depth charges at the time had a maximum limit of about 400 to 450 feet. They physically couldn't go deeper than that without exploding. And if you took a Baleo right down to sort of test depth, you're actually far enough below the maximum depth of the Japanese depth charges that they could know exactly where you were, and they could be dropping depth charges on you all day. It wouldn't be a particularly pleasant experience, but it was very unlikely that any of them would actually have the radius of effect to harm you, which therefore meant as long as you had several hundred feet of water to dive in, which isn't necessarily always going to be the case in the Pacific, you actually had an immunity as long as your battery lasted. And that would go on to save quite a number of crews, that stronger hull, through various combinations of the factors I just described. And obviously, the more longer a crew survives, the more effective they get. And sure. Suddenly, the effectiveness of the US subs starts dramatically increasing. Also coupled with the fact that, you know, the Mark 14 torpedo is not quite fixed, but most of the issues at the time that Tang goes out have been resolved.
That's which right. Is ironic for by Tang the way, specifically.
Yeah, we talked separately about the Kentucky congressman who gave away the secret that the Japanese depth charges were being set too shallow.
Oh, and, hey, yeah, know, congressman.
We talked about that yeah. Leak causing the death of 800 submariners. And another fun fact, Argonaut, which was O'Kane's first boat, had a riveted hull. Mm. I wouldn't want to go to sea on a riveted hull. And so the welded hull, and you're right, the lead in the ballast tanks was designed to do something called metacentric height, to increase the metacentric height between the center of buoyancy and the center of gravity, which improved stability. And by doing taking the lead away and thickening the hull, they had to do tricky things to not screw up that metacentric height, which would have caused the boat to roll on the surface. Mm. In an unstable fashion. So yeah, it was a clever design, and the thicker hull did mean it could go deeper, which had other benefits, as you say, but it also added more weight, and they were able to maintain the range happily.
Yeah.
You talk about test depth, you know, mm-hmm. Tang's test depth was about 400 feet, mm-hmm. and O'Kane being O'Kane, once he took Tang out for some basically testing, training, mm-hmm. trials, whatever you yeah. want to call it, off the coast of San Diego, sea trials, off the coast of San Diego, he decided he wanted to push Tang deep and see exactly how far she can go. He takes her down a little over 600 feet, which is for a World War II boat. That is deep.
You're approaching crush depth. You would not do that these days. You're not going to... test it through other means, not through, you know, going deep and finding out if you die. That's not a prescribed method of testing the boat.
Yeah, that is serious. And she sprung a few leaks. I mean, it wasn't anything obviously catastrophic, but it was enough to go, oh, okay, you know, that, we know we can go down there if we have to, but we really don't want to. Well, when he brought it up, go ahead.
Well, you're also risking what's called plastic deformity, which is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a scalloping of the hull, which and the superstructure, which doesn't do you any good when you go that deep. And so, you know, it's questionable as to whether he should have done that, but yeah, it does show a bit of guts.
Yeah, you know, from all accounts, he from anybody who that you know, after even writing his own book, but even guys who served on Tang and the few that survived, and even, you know, because there were guys that served aboard Tang and survived for long after. I knew a couple of them that weren't on the final patrol. They all said that, you know, he was constantly pushing the limits, not Mush Morton pushing the limits to, you know, like we said, he wasn't reckless, but, and Morton arguably was reckless, frankly, but you know, he was always trying to see, well, can I get just a little bit more out of this thing every single time he did something. But that particular dive scared the absolutely living bejesus out of a lot of guys aboard Tang, because, you know, they knew that O'Kane was this, you know, just badass sub skipper, but they're like, man, that's a little deep. And when they got back to San Diego, I think it was San Diego, or it might have been, no, it was San Francisco, several guys were like, I'm out, I'm gone. I don't care how cool this guy is, or, you know, what his reputation is. I'm not going 600 feet below beneath the surface again. I'm out. And several guys wanted transfers off of Tang after that. And that there's a couple of stories about the then chief of the boat, Ballinger, and Fraz getting into some physical altercations with a couple of sailors who said that they weren't going to report back to the boat on Monday morning, to which, needless to say, they eventually did. But it, you know, but testing and pushing the limits of submarines and testing and pushing the limits of your men are one thing. But O'Kane, having been aboard Wahoo, having been aboard Argonaut, and having been aboard Wahoo specifically serving under Kennedy, and realizing what poor morale can do to a crew, you know, and Bill and I've talked about this a lot of times, you know, that morale is kind of an under the radar type of thing that affects literally everything. You know, we did a whole series on Guadalcanal where we talked about the morale of the Marines. You know, it was usually high, and the Navy, which at times was very, very low. But O'Kane knew that a good morale aboard a boat means a happy crew, and a happy crew means an efficient boat. And he did something that wasn't, I thought it was rather funny, so I wanted to include it. He told Fraz, he says, there will be ice cream aboard Tang. And and that may seem like a small thing, but it really isn't, you know,
because I mean, deal.
Yeah, it is. And battleships, carriers, and heavy cruisers were usually the ones that had ice cream makers aboard the ships, and submarines most certainly did not. And it's pretty interesting that O'Kane instructed chief of the boat Ballinger. He said, go find me an ice cream maker. I don't care how you do it. He said, quote, by hook or by crook being the key word here. Find me an ice cream maker and get it installed aboard this submarine. And that's exactly what it did. Ballinger went and liberated the ice cream maker aboard the battleship Tennessee that was tied up in San Francisco at that time. And literally hours before, or just a couple hours after Tang had shoved off, apparently the shore patrol showed up looking for their ice cream maker that was now aboard a submarine. So you got to wonder how he got it off of there. But it's a pretty interesting story nonetheless.
Having been on a Beleo class submarine, I don't know where the heck you would have put it, in the cruise nest somewhere. No, just one of those things. Not a lot of space.
No.
I suspect for something like an ice cream maker, if you told the crew, well, you're going to have one less seat, or and then you get the ice cream maker, or you can have the seat back and no ice cream, it's not going to be much of an argument.
No, yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
Very good. Much.
He also did some technical things to improve the fighting ability of the boat. There's something called a TBT, which is a target bearing transmitter. Two devices can feed bearings into the torpedo data computer in the conning tower. One is, of course, the periscope, where you have a little pickle thing that you plunge, you squeeze to feed a bearing into the torpedo data computer, TDC. But on the bridge, you had something called a target bearing transmitter, which is like a binnacle. He mounted a higher powered set of binoculars. And of course, that took very careful calibration to make sure the binoculars were perfectly aligned with the bearing that the TBT was trying to transmit to the TDC. Sorry about the acronyms, but abbreviations. But, you know, he did that as well. And it really made those very tiny mast on the horizon targets a whole lot easier to pick out and send those bearings to the TDC so they could line up. As I described in our torpedo attack episode, really important to get ahead of the target's course, maneuver early so that you can intercept, get to the intercept point. Because you're not chasing the target, you're chasing where the target's going to be. And his modification to the TBT helped with that.
He did something else too that I don't want to necessarily say it's revolutionary, but it certainly helped, as you'll see in his scoring as far as ships sunk, as he put a ton of guys topside when they were on the surface, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean,
smothered cigarette bridge. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's funny reading about it occurring in a submarine in World War II, because this is pretty much, it's the re-evolution of fire control as was found in World War I, because, you know, before World War I, your spotting and fire control was generally, you know, three guys up at the top of the foremast with some handheld binoculars. And occasionally, if you were unfortunate enough to serve in particular Royal Navy ship classes, some genius decided to put the mast behind the forward funnel with all the subsequent effects you can imagine. But as time went on, immediately in the run-up to and during World War One, you had the development of range finders. And, you know, the main thing with the range finders to get better clarity and better accuracy was to make them larger and larger and larger, which is pretty much what O'Kane's now doing on a sub. You can't fit a 15-foot range finder on top of a sub, apart from anything that would look stupid, and it probably wouldn't survive the dive. But, you know, bigger binoculars than standard issue gives you an inbuilt advantage. And the other thing that was discovered back in World War One was, again, once you can actually hit things out to the horizon, you need a lot of people, because it's relatively easy for two or three guys to be scanning out to a few thousand yards. But once you're talking about tens of thousands of yards, the target's much, much smaller, and you can only therefore get a certain amount of detail out of every sweep that you're doing, whether that be with your own eyes or with some kind of binocular or telescope device. And so the chances of picking up targets quickly, whether they be things you want to go after or things that are coming after you and makes you need to dive, that exponentially increases the more people who are up there. So in some ways, although she is supposed to be a sub and supposed to be doing lots of sneaking around, he's effectively outfitting her as a very offensive platform to go out and seek and destroy the enemy, as opposed to a defensive platform, which some subs would run as, where you'd have like two or three people. And as soon as you see anything so much as twitch, everyone's down the hatch and you're underwater and wait to see what's happened. Which also, as some similar to what we were discussing earlier, it speaks to the mindset. You know, there is an inherent disadvantage to doing all of this, because if you have, you know, half a dozen or a dozen men up top, if something does happen, like a aircraft carrying depth charges shows up, it's going to take you longer to get those men down. It's going to take you longer to get underwater. And that's a risk, but it's a defensive situation risk. And you're balancing that against the benefit of better target acquisition and quicker target acquisition. And all of that, as I said, reflects the mindset of the captain. What is he looking to do? Is he looking to go out there and possibly engage the enemy, but run from everything that, you know, that sort of twitches slightly? Or is he out there to basically attack the enemy? And if the enemy decides to come back at him, well, we'll deal with that when it comes.
Yeah, and to
like a submariner track. Are you sure you weren't a submariner? That's precisely the points I was going to make. Well done.
Well, I might have ended up in a different timeline. I think I might have well have ended up in subs.
Yeah. To that point, you know, Kane would put upwards of seven people topside when they were on the surface, which was most of the time, frankly. Too, he took that note out of Mush Morton's handbook of, you know, you can get to your target destination or your patrol area quicker on the surface. You can make faster in runs on targets on the surface. And, you know, he wasn't stupid. He knew, to your point, Trek, that the more eyes you got up top, you're going, you know, you're more likely to see things. And two, you know, the more eyes you got on top, you're more likely to, you know, be able to see things coming after you, which is a huge thing. And to the point where he constantly, on his way out of it towards for his first patrol, as skipper of Tang, they constantly drilled crash dives, emergency dives, and he constantly had these people. And it wasn't always the same seven people topside either. You know, it was a bunch of different guys, and he rotated people in and out all the time because he wanted everybody to be efficient at that job. He could get people down below have the hatch dogged, everything, and start going down underneath the surface in under 30 seconds, which is cooking. I mean, that's serious, you know.
It's important to remember, after not too long, when you're up there on lookout, you know, whether you're off the deck or lookout, you get bleary-eyed very quickly. I'm talking 15, 20 minutes. And, you know, standard watch was 4 hours. And so he would be rotating the lookouts more often than that, sometimes as often as once an hour, once every 2 hours, pretty routine. Really, really did improve their efficiency. That disrupted the rotation of the crew as well. So there's downside to everything. But it's really hard to stay sharp-eyed for multiple hours in a row, particularly at night.
And, you know, go ahead, Jack. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, but this also actually reflects some sort of related to what we were saying before about the advantages of a Balao and U.S. fleet submarines generally. They had, although at the time, obviously, everyone is running diesel-electric subs, they have to stay on the surface for a considerable portion of time. But the U.S. fleet subs have an inbuilt advantage in this field because they're some of the biggest subs out there. There are some Japanese subs that are a little bit larger. But because they're designed as these fleet subs and the original intention was for them to run with a battle fleet, they're actually supposed to spend even more time on the surface in their original design role. And so they are really at home there. They've got a fairly high turn of speed for a World War II sub on the surface and pretty decent underwater speed as well. And this means in the wide expanses of the Pacific, if you have for a submarine, relatively speaking, stable lookout platform, and it's a little bit larger, so you can get people a little bit higher, you can see a little bit further. And then when you see something, you can get there a little bit quicker. All of this is all little small advantages that can then be built by the correct crew into a very efficient fighting machine. Whereas, you know, if you were to take something that was more typical for the Battle of the Atlantic, like a German Type 7, I wouldn't want to be out on watch duty and for 4 hours on a Type 7, not unless you really, really, really like roller coasters. Not to mention the fact you'd probably run out of fuel halfway across the Pacific and have to go home again.
Yeah, very, very true. You know, O'Kane had a quote that is typical O'Kane. He said, you know, the Pacific's a big ocean. You don't have to find the enemy if you don't want to. And that's, you know, straight to both of your points, is that he was out there. That's why he put seven people. It wasn't just defensive to make sure that aircraft weren't going to sneak up on him like they did on Mushmorton. You know, it was not that he knew that happened, but regardless, you know, he put seven guys up in those up top side, even all the way up into the shears of the periscope, you know, to find targets, to sink them and kill them, because that was his job. And he knew that. So to that end, he takes Tang out on her first war patrol on January 24th, 1944. She departs Pearl Harbor. She's bound for the Caroline Marshall Islands area. It's not long after, it's only a few weeks or a couple weeks after, on February 16th, Tang sights a convoy of two freighters and five smaller vessels and one escort. She's given the bearings on this convoy via an ultra message. She'd been actually out there for a couple weeks and hadn't seen, you know, as much as a rowboat. And the crew was starting to get a little deflated, shall we say, because they hadn't had the opportunity to do what they were trained to do. And O'Kane was starting to get a little frustrated himself. But as they get this ultra message, he knows that this is probably going to be, you know, a hot target area. So he rings up flank speed and they start cranking on the surface to the proposed interception point. He goes throughout the crew, or he goes throughout the boat, rather, I'm sorry, to the crew, and just starts talking to them and starts saying, hey, you know, we're probably going to get into some action here. This is it. This is what you guys have trained for. Do your jobs and, you know, everybody's going to come out fine. And, you know, in his book and in subsequent books that were written about him and Tang, they all said the same thing, that, you know, you could feel the energy aboard the boat just like lift, boom, because the guys knew they were getting ready to get into the fray, so to speak. Radar picked up the convoy at a range of over 31,000 yards, which is pretty significant. and Bill, you know, you and I have talked about radar ad nauseum in the Guadalcanal episodes. This is a further advancement of that Guadalcanal era radar. You know, I'm not a big on radar, but I mean, I don't know a whole lot of the intricacies about it, but I mean, 31,000 yards radar pickup on a submarine, that's serious.
Yeah, and this was, of course, surface ship surface search radar. Right. Some of our listeners will know that there was a periscope radar that you could ping like manually in the direction that you're training the scope. Tang did not have that. Okane, in his later patrols, was demanding that periscope radar be put on a ship, but that's not what this is. This is general surface search radar, and that's an incredible range, really good operators. A-scan type radar, so you could tell a little bit about the size of the ships, not the later PPI scans that we had. But so this gives you all the information you need to pull ahead of the convoy and get into firing position. Now, I want to say something about that ultra message, because again, I'm going to jump ahead and reveal that shockingly, I'm going to surprise everybody that's listening to this podcast. Tang ends up sinking some ships. Now,
just a few.
You don't report we've just sunk this unless there's a really valid reason to do so. You don't go active on the radio and make a report. But the sub-pack kind of knows that ships are being sunk in the vicinity where Tang was supposed to operate. And a later ultra report picks up the fact that the convoy has changed course to a base course of north and reports to Tang O'Kane saying the convoy that you are apparently attacking, because Subback knows that some ships have been sunk and assumes that Tang is attacking them, is the cause for those ships being sunk. You should know that the convoy that you're apparently attacking has changed to base course of north. These ultra reports, when they were available, were incredibly useful for skippers like O'Kane. And these kind of things didn't happen earlier in the war. Add to the fact that Mark 14 torpedoes didn't work well early in the war. I'm kind of building the scenario here that O'Kane had some advantages.
Oh, yeah.
That the earlier skippers, even Mush Morton, didn't have. But boy, did he make use of them. And turn them into sinkings.
He absolutely did. And he brings Tang up to an area that's just forward of the convoy. And despite the 31,000 yards picking up on radar of the convoy, there's an escort that actually basically gets behind him and surprises him and forces Tang to dive. He didn't see it on radar. He didn't see it until it was really almost too late. He crash dives Tang, and this track to your point earlier, he brings Tang down below the gradient of like well below 450 feet. And you know, the Japanese destroyer or escort, I don't know if it's a destroyer or a DE or a piece or whatever, it drops about 5 depth charges on top of him and then just keeps on cooking. But the depth charges, it's the first time his crew's under fire. The depth charges do absolutely nothing. I don't even think they, you know, pop some light bulbs in there. And it just, you know, to your point earlier, you know, Tang's 450 feet beneath the surface and just shrugs these things off like they're nothing at all. The one mistake that the escort did was that they dropped Joe's 5 depth charges and then left Tang alone, which is probably not the thing to do. You want to prosecute that boat as much as you can. And, you know, I guess they were in a hurry. I really don't frankly know. As he brings O'Kane brings the submarine back up, he sweeps with radar and found that he was 9,000 yards ahead of the proposed target track. O'Kane plots his course, and this is incredibly important. This goes back to our episode on Wahoo when we talked about Kennedy not being able to, you know, plot an attack course, you know, out of a paper bag. He couldn't figure out how to do it properly, or didn't want to, one or the other. O'Kane does it with such precision that when he is ready to make his attack, the submarine is actually inside of the convoy. And this is not the last time that this will happen. But he's submerged, I believe, on this attack. Is he not? I think he was. He fires...
certainly, when he's inside the convoy, at this time, he was submerged. There are going to be other times we'll talk about where he's inside the convoy, inside the screen, on the surface, at night, of course. Yeah,
and that's just nuts. And we'll get to that. It's serious stuff. You know, he fires 4 torpedoes. He hits the first ship that Tang hits is called the Gyoten Maru. Gyoten. I'm horrible with Japanese pronunciations. do not sue me, I'm sorry. But Tang blows the stern off of her first kill. More importantly, due to post-war records, we know that over 1,000 Imperial Japanese Army soldiers went down with that ship. So those are 1,000 guys that could have or would have more than likely been in contact with Allied troops that never made it ashore. We talk about, you know, ship kills and, you know, sinking merchantmen and things like this. But one important aspect of the submarine war, especially in the Pacific, is that, you know, there were a lot of troop transports that were sunk. There are a lot of enemy, you know, Japanese Imperial Army soldiers that never made it to where they needed to be because of submarine attacks much like this. You know, I don't think we know the final destination of these guys, but that's 1,000 guys that never made it there.
Yeah, and it's also about, you know, there's the immediate effect of there's 1,000 troops that aren't making it to wherever they're going. But there's also the knock-on effect, because dedicated troop transports were relatively uncommon. So every one of those that you knock out is a significant blow to the enemy's capability to move men around. This one's a freighter, but even amongst merchant ships, regular freighters and so forth, certain types of freighter are much better suited to transporting troops than others. So, you know, if you've got something that's a bulk carrier that's designed to haul grain or coal or something like that, and it's effectively a series of very large boxes wrapped in a hull, that's awful for moving troops around in. You really want something with multiple decks, something that's designed to move lots of smaller bits of cargo, but that's a very small element of your overall freighter fleet. You know, you're not going to use tankers either. And that small element will have other specialized cargoes that it really needs to be shifting around. And if you've sunk enough of the troop transports, you're forcing your enemy to now use these freighters, then that's other cargo that they can't move on that voyage. If you then knock out those ships as well, not only are you taking out the troops, but you're also forcing them, A, to lose capacity for moving other supplies around, but B, it means that they're going to have to gradually start putting troops on less and less suitable ships, which means that per sailing, they have fewer men going out to reinforce, which they, it all has a snowball effect going on. So it's why troop transports, whether they be dedicated or sort of rush jobs, are such important targets in World War II. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not necessarily that he knows that this particular ship is carrying troops, but the fact that he hit it, you know, would have had a lot of knock-on effects further down the line than perhaps he could have initially anticipated.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point, and there's something too to be said about this, and I know we'll talk about this in later submarine episodes and different things like that. Is that, you know, to your point about hauling troops, and there were a few troop transport ships, but I mean, they'd put them aboard freighters. They put anything that floated, if they could move people there. I mean, hell, in Guadalcanal, they were putting them aboard destroyers. They also moved Allied prisoners of war aboard these ships, you know, to the case of Mush Morton and Wahoo, and they sunk, I forget, Buyomaru. And it had Indian prisoners of war aboard. You know, there's several instances of, I believe it was USS Pompanito that's currently in San Francisco, sank a couple of ships that had Australian prisoners of war aboard. You know, so they were collateral damage in the sinking of ships, and they were, of course, Japanese did not mark them as such, for better, or, you know, either on purpose or not, regardless. But you know, there was a lot of times when there were Allied prisoners of war that were unwittingly sunk and killed by American submarines because they were improperly marked. And to your point, they put them aboard anything that floated so they could get them to wherever it was that they needed to put these people, or wherever the Japanese wanted to put these people, I should say. So, and we'll see in Tang's later escapades that, you know, that very thing happens to some of her survivors. After her first kill, she's ordered around to the waters around Saipan and the Mariana Islands to stalk what, you know, is thought to be another convoy. This is another ultra message, Bill, to your very point you made just a couple minutes ago. This time she's attacking utilizing Dick O'Kane's favorite method of attacking, which is on the surface. You know, he was fully aware that, you know, a submerged submarine is a, quote, safe submarine, unquote. But a surface submarine is A, more aggressive, and B, as we'll see later, she can get out of the situation a heck of a lot faster than she got into it. As they say, you know, the movie Kelly's Heroes. You know, they say we like to think we can get out of trouble faster than we got into it. The same thing with O'Kane. You know, he liked to think that they could get out of trouble faster than they could get into it. Therefore, prosecuting those types of attacks on the surface is exactly what he liked to do best. And this is his first surface attack with Tang. They hit a ship called the Fukuyama Maru, and it virtually disintegrates. I mean, they just blow this thing. It's, you know, to use the terms of our good friend John Parshall, they turn the Fukuyama Maru into metal confetti. They just blow this thing all over the water. At that point, an escort that was, again, for whatever reason, unseen by Tang, decides to give Tang a run for her money. On the surface now, Tang gets away. She does make a clean getaway, and she turns around not to be denied. Typical Dick O'Kane. He says, "Oh, well, we sunk one, but there's still others to go get, so let's go get some more." That's exactly what he does. He swings the thing around, and this time it's nighttime. He's under the cover of a rain squall. He fires three torpedoes at 8-second intervals, and this is a classic maneuver by Richard O'Kane. What he wanted to do, especially on the surface, is fling out so many torpedoes at so many different targets so fast that he created utter confusion so that nobody save him and the men aboard his boat knew what the hell was going on. He wanted it to basically look like the 4th of July so he could, you know, make a clean getaway. And that's exactly what he does. He hits the Yamashiro Maru, which was a tender. She absorbed three torpedoes, explodes violently. O'Kane was so shocked by the explosion. It was very clear that this thing was carrying munitions. It's thought now post-war that she was probably carrying warheads for those dreaded Japanese torpedoes because it just, boom. I mean, like a nuke going off on the surface of the water. The blast forced O'Kane. It literally blew him back on the bridge of Tang, and he yells down below, down to the hatch, which was open to Frazee. He says, "You know, is everything okay?" And they start making checks all over the boat because the explosion was so violent that he actually felt that pressure wave come back and wanted to make sure that everything was fine. But again, Drac, to your point, that Baleo class boat just took it and just kept on trucking. It didn't do a damn thing. I don't even think she sprung a leak. She might have knocked a plate off the bulkhead, but that would have been about it.
Yeah, and it also shows how he's exploiting the technology that's become available to him in a way that, you know, earlier submarines couldn't, and the Japanese definitely couldn't, because, you know, if this was an engagement in the Battle of the Atlantic in 1944, the submarine that runs in on the surface would have been spotted by radar equipped on the escorts and attacked very early. The Japanese escorts don't have surface search radar by and large, even by this stage in the war. I mean, even later down the line, when you get to things like the Battle of Samar, even then, relatively few Japanese capital ships have some form of radar. So small anti-sub escorts, they're very low down the pecking order. But Tang does have radar, as we already mentioned, which means that, again, sort of shades of Samar, she's able to go into this rain squall, but maintain contact with the convoy. So she knows, right, we've broken visual contact but with the enemy, but so the enemy doesn't know where we are, but we still have the radar contact, so we can now redeploy, come around and hit the convoy again, which, you know, a submarine in 1942 probably couldn't have done. But and sort of looping back to our point about crews, a submarine skipper in 1944, even if he has this capability, could go, okay, you know, we didn't see this escort. We've actually not seen an escort twice. We've done our attack. We've sunk something. Let's decide that discretion is the better part of valor and use this contact to break away. Whereas O'Kane is going, no, okay, well, you know, we can still see the enemy. The enemy's still there. Why? We still have torpedoes. Why do I still have torpedoes left?
Yeah. You know, Mush Morton used to have a phrase that he told O'Kane all the time when they were aboard Wahoo. And O'Kane used to say it to Fraz all the time aboard Tang. He said, "Tenacity, Dick, stick with the bastards until they're on the bottom." And he used to say the exact same thing to Fraz, you know, aboard Tang, that, you know, is if there are targets there and I can shoot them, we are going to shoot them. You know, if it might take us all day to get there, but by God, we're going to put these people on the bottom, because that's what they were out there to do. You know, and he wasn't going to turn that boat around and bring it back to Midway, Pearl Harbor, wherever he was assigned to go until they were out of torpedoes, you know, and even then, maybe, you know, but A couple days later, he runs into another convoy, which he tracks and attacks again on the surface, again at night. She sank a large freighter, then submerged for another attack from a range of only like 500 yards, which is close, Bill. That's close.
One of the, you know, the audacity of these, some of these attacks are incredible. So if you're going to, there's a couple of things you could do to minimize the possibility that you're going to miss. One is shoot what's called a zero gyro angle on the torpedoes, which means you head your ship at a course where the torpedo, once it exits the torpedo tube, doesn't have to turn. Because anytime the torpedo has to turn, there's gyro imprecision, inaccuracies. There's a chance that torpedo is going to end up on the wrong torpedo course and miss from that regard. So if you steer the ship so that the torpedo can run straight down the intercept course, that minimizes one error that might cause you to miss. The other one is range. Mm-hmm. Closing the target as much as possible, as you said, Seth, in this case, to an incredible range of 500 yards. Let me tell you, that ship is very large in your periscope at a range of 500 yards. Really scary. But the chance you're going to make some kind of course error or any other kind of error at that range is reduced. So you close to the point that's barely enough time for the torpedo to arm before it impacts. And so he would do these very audacious things to improve his chances for success. Drac, you got to know that there are other times when things like this happen, right? Where we're firing at range that's dangerous.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was going to cover the same point about the arming distance. There are mm-hmm. submarines that try this kind of tactic on all sides, and statistically, there are a fair number of attacks where they launch their torpedoes and the torpedo just goes thud because it's not armed itself yet. Because, you know, this is the thing. You see, if you're engaging at, let's say, 3,000 yards now, and you make a slight error in your range calculation, well, it doesn't really matter if you're 3,050 yards or 2,950 yards away. The torpedo is still armed, and if you've aimed it properly, it means, well, you hit the bow or the stern instead of amidship. So, you know, what's the big deal? But if you're at 500 yards and you make a 50-yard range error, you're still going to hit because, as you said, you know, you're a lot closer. But that could be the difference between the torpedo going off or not going off. Or it could be the difference because obviously you can also fiddle around with the arming distance if you want to. It could also be the difference of when the torpedo explodes, does it damage the target or does it damage the target and possibly also damage you? Especially if you're on the surface, because there's not just the shockwave of the torpedo exploding, because the torpedo has a much, much bigger warhead than your average depth charge. But on the surface, you've also got the possibility even of flying debris. And more than one submariner has come home with injured crew or a peppered sail because they pulled off this kind of thing. And, random bits of target or bits of their own torpedo came flying back at high speed. So you've got to be very confident in your capabilities to pull it off, and also lucky, which is another very important component of being a submarine commander, to pull it off successfully.
Needless to say, needless to say, the torpedo does go boom. 500 yards estimated ranges. That's what O'Kane said in his patrol report. It hits the side of this Japanese ship, and O'Kane's watching, and he's watching guys literally being blown off the vessel as the torpedo just slams into it. It's a large freighter. I do not have the name of the
images
vessel.
Of Juno there, huh?
Say again.
Images of Juno.
Of guys, you know, literally standing there 1 second and going through the air the next. Well, now she is out of torpedoes. Tang turns around. She gets orders to head for Midway, and just, I'm gonna throw this figure at you. She is armed with 24 torpedoes. She shoots all 24 and she scores 16 hits. Considering the trials and tribulations of American torpedoes, this is really, really good. She sinks five ships on her very first patrol, 16 out of 24 hits. That's not only is that good shooting, to your point earlier, Bill, you know, most of the American torpedo problems have seemingly been eradicated at this point. So she goes to Midway, which was not a preferred destination for American submarine crews. I've never personally been to Midway. I'd love to go one day, but there is nothing on Midway except for, I think there was a small, you know,
Goonie Birds
hotel and Goonie Birds. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They had a place. I say hotel. It wasn't actually a hotel, but it was a quarters for submarine crews, but they called it the Goonie Bird Hotel there aboard Midway. For her second patrol, and we'll just touch on this briefly so we can get to the meat, but the second patrol is something that O'Kane is on record saying, don't want to do this at all. She is sent to the area around Truk to serve as lifeguard. And by lifeguard, I mean she is there for one reason and one reason. She's armed, but she's there for one reason and one reason only, and that is to pick up Allied, or in this particular case, American naval aviators who would, you know, be in the drink. There is a American carrier raid on Truk proceeding at this very same time, and Tang's job is to pick these people up out of the water as they go down. There are a couple of instances where O'Kane takes Tang inside, or very, very close to being inside a reef to go get people. He sends some of his crew out in rubber boats to go rescue these downed American naval aviators and bring them aboard Tang. He brings back a record 22 American aviators. There's a really famous picture of O'Kane and all the aviators that he rescued, or that his boat rescued, standing topside of Tang after they bring him back to Pearl Harbor. And if you look at the picture of O'Kane, you could tell that he's not, this wasn't what he was sent out there to do, you know? I mean, he did the job and he did it well. Typical of Richard O'Kane and USS Tang, you know, they hauled in 22 aviators, which was a record for rescues. And you look at O'Kane's face in the picture, and he's not exactly pleased with himself or pleased with the mission. But I guarantee you those 22 guys were. I can tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it also speaks to the level of resources that the US is able to deploy at this point, because as we know, the Japanese naval aviation community by this point had been completely decimated by American anti-aircraft firepower. 22 aviators, obviously not necessarily all of them are going to be pilots. Some of them will be crews, you know, tail gunners or navigators. But you're talking about roughly a quarter of the air complement in terms of men for a fleet carrier. So there's a quarter of a fleet carrier's air group that you've recovered that you would otherwise have lost. That's a lot of skill. That's a lot of training and effort that's gone into those men, plus of course, you know, 22 families who aren't losing someone,
right,
and who are then able to be recycled back onto the carriers to keep up their strikes. And you think about some of the Japanese losses prior to this, in some of the bigger air battles. What would the Japanese have paid to be able to recover 22 experienced air crew? Yeah. And this is just Tang on one submarine on one patrol. And when you consider that, you know, these patrols are going on quite a lot at this stage, and some of the bigger air attacks have multiple subs doing rescues, it may not have been his personal favorite mission, right, but it's still a very, very important one.
Critical. That's precisely the point I was going to make. And it would be interesting to track those 22 aviators and find out what damage they did to the Japanese Empire following their rescue and recovery. This is more work that's helping to win the war effort.
Funny you should mention that, Bill, because in my career, one of the guys that was rescued by USS Tang was a gentleman named Bob Kanzi. He was a naval aviator. He was at this point, F-6F Hellcat pilot. Previous to the Truk raid, he was an F-4F Wildcat pilot. He was actually an NAP, which is an enlisted pilot, which is something that you see very early in the Pacific War from the American side. He flew in the Battle of Coral Sea. He'd had a couple of kills. I'm trying to look it up on the right now. I forget how many kills he had. I don't believe he was a ace finally, but regardless of this, he was a highly, highly, highly experienced naval aviator, who had seen a lot of war and he still had a lot of water left to see. He, you know, because of his rescue by Tang, he does go back out there. He does go back out to the Pacific and completes his tour of duty. And this is, you know, one of those, I don't want to say, you know, any human life is irreplaceable, but this is particular, to your point, Drac, a typical American rescue, in that, you know, you've got this highly experienced aviator who's seen a lot of war, who's still got a lot of war to see, that because of the efforts of Tang, and there were certainly other submarines around the truck area performing lifeguard duty, Tang just happened to be one of them, that these guys are saved, and that precious, precious, precious experience, expertise, skill level doesn't disappear in a Japanese prison camp or down to the depths of the Pacific Ocean. You know, it's because of these types of efforts. And you'll see these lifeguard rescue efforts basically throughout the rest of the war. Whenever there was a major amphibious operation, be it, you know, the Marianas operation or Okinawa or Iwo Jima or whatever, especially when we're bombing Japan with B-29s, there were submarines stationed everywhere. And the aviators knew where these submarines relatively where they were, so they could put down in the water to hopefully be rescued by submarines. So this isn't the first instance of this. And dang sure isn't the last.
Reminder that George H.W. Bush was rescued by a submarine off Chichi Jima. So future president.
Yeah. So I mean, it's So I mean, it's very important. And you know, Kanzi was just one example of these guys that that were rescued. And just a quick side note: when I was in Hawaii a month ago, we went to the submarine museum there at the USS Bofin, and they have an outstanding World War II submarine exhibit. You know, it's fairly large, and artifacts in there. You know, they got Wahoo's original battle flag and all kinds of things in there that are just, you know, for guys like us, you just see it, you go, oh boy, you know, it's just really cool. One of the things they had in there was a Mae West that was issued to one of the naval aviators that Tang rescued, and it's sitting in a case right above the picture, that picture that I was talking about. And every single one of the aviators that was rescued by Tang on that mission signed that Mae West. And I'm standing there at my wife and kids, and I'm looking at it. And I'm like, I wonder if his name is there. And damn, there sure it is. Bob Kanzi's name was there. And I was like, look, guys, I knew that guy.
It really is a really good museum. And more importantly, well, it's air conditioned.
Yeah.
Yes.
I lived there for 11 years, and I never got tired of going to that place. It's that good.
It's awesome. It's awesome. Well, getting back to Tang and her war patrols. Now, she goes out for her third war patrol. This is a big one, not only because it's her third war patrol, but this is a record breaker. You know, we talked about Wahoo, and that on her fourth patrol, I believe it was, she set the record. She set the precedent for everybody else to follow for many ships sunk on one patrol, and that record would not be broken until USS Tang and Richard O. Kane breaks that record here on her third patrol. She departs from Pearl on June 8, 1944, her patrol area is designated as the East China Sea and the Yellow Sea. Now, to my earlier point, O'Kane had been in this area before aboard Wahoo for her fourth war patrol. And because of that, O'Kane brings the war patrol report that he had from Wahoo aboard Tang for this patrol. And as he's going, as the boat is heading out to the patrol area, he's reading this thing backwards and forwards and upside down and sideways, you know, absorbing as much as he can from that patrol that happened, you know, to him so long ago into these hot waters. On the 24th of June, Tang is prowling the waters off Kagoshima when her lookouts spot a convoy of six ships guarded by 16 escorts. It's usually the other way around.
Japanese was keeping all their escorts.
Yeah, it's usually the other way around. It's 16 ships by six escorts, but I mean, good gravy.
Something important.
You think? Yeah. I mean, Drac, have you ever heard of anything like that? I mean, six ships and 16 escorts?
No, I mean, to be honest, you know, even in the Battle of the Atlantic, where you've got the, you know, combined industrial power of Britain, America, and Canada chucking escorts into the water, you'd be hard pressed to find many convoys that have got 16 escorts.
Yeah.
Now, granted, in this particular operational area, we know that, you know, Japanese escorts could range from dedicated anti-submarine escorts, which were relatively rare, to some of their older World War I destroyers, which were no longer viable as fleet combatants, which they'd refitted to patrol ships, and down to, you know, submarine chases and other things. They're not really true oceanic escorts, but in this particular area, they can usually survive a few days at sea running back and forth. But still, you know, like we were saying before, it's more eyes looking around for targets, more systems, more depth charges, and they're just physically in more spaces. So there's fewer areas that you can safely run through to get at the actual targets that you want, because, you know, chalking up anti-submarine escort kills is all well and good, but if at the end of the day, if you blow away half a dozen sub chasers and these six big freighters get through, that's probably a net win for the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And I guess you could maybe classify these as maybe coastal escorts, because, I mean, he's pretty close. I mean, he's not, you know, inshore, but he's pretty close to the Japanese coast. And to your point, you know, these aren't guys that are going to be, these aren't ships that are going to leave, you know, Hokkaido and bring things out to the Philippines. These aren't the people that are going to do that. These aren't the vessels. But regardless of that, they got guns and they got depth charges, and that's a serious threat on Tang, to the point where when they're on the surface and he sights this, one of his lookouts, Quartermaster Sidney Jones, basically speaks for the entire bridge watch when he sees all these escorts. He goes, "Quote, Christ Almighty." End quote.
Yeah. So, you also have to bear in mind at this point, the Japanese have also invented the underwater shell for their anti-submarine weapons. So, you know, the Allied escorts were using depth charges and Hedgehog for the most part. The Japanese lacking most of those advances, although obviously they do have depth charges, they've actually invented specialist shells designed for anti-submarine work, which will actually retain their energy and dive underwater a considerable distance. So getting in a gunfight with the Japanese escort is actually more hazardous than you might think, because if you, you know, if you're running your sub quite low in the water, maybe only the sail is out of the water, in most circumstances that's a fairly small target to hit. But by 1944, if you end up in a gunfight with a Japanese escort, if they hit somewhere in front of your entire length, there's a chance that one of these underwater shells might come through and punch a hole in your pressure hull. So, you know, again, it's like, it may be some smaller escorts and only a few large ones, but anything that can carry, you know, a 3-inch gun or bigger is potentially a lethal threat.
Yeah, I was unaware of that. I did not know that they had developed that type of munition. Do we have any record of them? I mean, obviously they utilized them, but do we have any record of them actually, you know, killing an American submarine with these things?
I don't know off the top of my head if there's a specific instance where we can point to, you know, this sub was hit by this shell and it specifically killed it. I know there are some records where a sub was attacked and damaged by those, and then obviously they chucked depth charges at it subsequently, so exactly what was the cause of loss is a bit open for debate. And we do know that some subs would come back with holes from these shells, which is how the US actually found out about them, when a sub fetched up with a shell and like, hey, this thing, you know, this thing poked a hole in the sub, but how did that work, because this bit of the hole was like 6 foot underwater. And then they examined it and found out, you know, what changes they've made to the shape of the shell and the length of the fusing and so forth. And then they're not like a wonder weapon.
Right.
There's certainly no replacement for something like Hedgehog launchers. But they do bring an additional element of lethality to trying to sneak past even the small escorts.
Sneak past the smaller escorts. Well, that is Tang in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah.
To that point, the radar picture tells O'Kane that there are six large ships in two columns with the escorts in a circular pattern around them. Kind of looks like an egg. On the surface, Richard O'Kane navigates Tang to a position inside the escorts. This is a tactic that he continually uses, working his boat to the rear of the formation. As he positioned for an attack, Tang was inside the enemy convoy on the surface with the nearest escort only a mile away. On both sides of Tang. I've used this phrase before and I'll use it again for Richard O'Kane in this particular instance, balls of solid rock. To bring your submarine on the surface, I don't care if it's at night, inside of an enemy convoy with escorts on either side of you a mile or less away, that is supreme confidence in not only your ability, but everybody that's riding in that submarine. That's just, that is incredible. That is absolutely incredible.
You know, the good news is it doesn't matter which way you fire, you got enemy in front of you.
Oh, you're not kidding. You're not kidding. So he readies all tubes for firing as he draws the boat closer to her intended victims. And a flurry of just a few seconds, O'Kane fires, this is a typical tactic of his, fires three torpedoes at the leading target, shifts targets, fires three more torpedoes at a tanker. Their torpedoes were fired so fast that they all had the same runtime of roughly 1 minute and 47 seconds.
Now, let me set this up for a minute, Seth, because what that requires is shifting, but you don't start tracking the target after you fire the weapons from the last target. You've got to track these multiple contacts simultaneously. And then right at the end, what you end up doing is say, continuous bearing on target one. Okay, and then shoot target one, continuous bearing on target two. But you already have target two set up with a solution ready to fire. That's the only way to do this. But this is calculus, not arithmetic. This is not easy to do. It requires a lot of practice and a lot of that genius mental power that very few CEOs had. O'Kane was one of them.
Absolutely. You know, we said this on the Wahoo episode, that he had this trigonometric mind that could calculate the angle on the bow of these targets within seconds in his mind. And he was one of the, to your point, Bill, one of the few human beings on Earth that could do this that quick. And again, this goes to the point, if he was put on this planet to do one thing, and this is it. In a blinding flash, all six torpedoes hit almost simultaneously, literally within seconds of each other. Boom, 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 down the line. Both of the targets that O'Kane had shot at were already sinking. Unbeknownst to O'Kane, though, the six torpedoes that he had fired actually sank four ships. And at this point, this is the most successful submarine shot by an American submarine of the war. You know, one salvo, if you will, of all six bow tubes sinks four Japanese ships in a span of, I don't know, you know, 30 seconds.
Advantage being a target-rich environment, I guess.
I'm telling you, man. I mean, the targets were literally overlapping one another at this point. Immediately after the explosions, O'Kane's like, all right, we're gone. He turns the boat around, reverses course, flank speed. You know, the escorts are now there. Searchlights popping up everywhere. There's gunfire everywhere. And O'Kane, still on the surface, mind you, takes Tang out of there as fast as he can. Excuse me. The escorts
are reloading.
While reloading, exactly. The escorts are running all over God's creation, dropping depth charges on a ghost target because they thought that the submarine was actually submerged. When lo and behold, she's on the surface, you know, beating feet behind them, trying to get out of the area. On the 30th of June, Tang spots another single freighter. O'Kane positioned the boat to fire from the stern using the slower wakeless torpedoes. As he fired two fish at the tanker, O'Kane let out, according to witnesses aboard the boat and O'Kane himself, let out a flurry of profanity as both torpedoes broached the surface, porpoised, sprayed water, giving away their position, allowing the enemy vessel to swing away from the torpedoes. The useless fish plowed through the surf and exploded on the beach. So while we said that American torpedo problems had been fixed, this is a case that they're not, right?
Yeah, this is the Mark 18.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My favorite punching bag when it comes, it's like if you want to line up a target that everyone can agree on, in World War II in the US, it's the Bureau of Ordnance when it comes to torpedoes.
Yep.
Because as you said, you know, they've spent a year and a half denying there's a problem with the Mark 14. We're now at the point in 1944 where pretty much most of the issues are fixed, as Tang is proving in rather spectacularly explosive manner. But then in 1943, they've introduced the Mark 18, which is an electric torpedo. And oh boy, does this thing have almost as many issues as the Mark 14. Now, the one good thing about the Mark 18, if it hits, it will probably explode.
It doesn't have the exploder problems.
No.
It invents new problems.
Yeah. It's just getting it to actually get to the target in the first place proves to be something of a bigger issue. The backstory to that is that the US was trying to make its own electric torpedo, the Mark 20, and let's just say that wasn't working out very well, then the Germans, during their happy time off the East Coast, fire their G7E electric torpedoes, and some of those miss and wind up
on the beach,
both on the US East Coast, and they get some in U-boats that they've captured. And Bureau of Ordnance is basically told, you have until this fixed date to either get the Mark 20 working or just copy this one, because we know it works. And in classic Bureau of Ordnance style, they decide to split down the middle and do neither of these things. So they do abandon the Mark 20, but instead of copying the G7E outright, they go, but we think we can improve it.
Of course.
Which, yeah, given that they've already, you know, they failed to produce their own version and you've got the Mark 14 debacle behind them, you can understand why this doesn't inspire a huge amount of confidence when they say, oh, our new wonder weapon has arrived. And one of its earliest faults was the fact that the batteries they used gave off insane amounts of hydrogen for no apparent reason, because batteries aren't supposed to do that. Admiral Lockwood actually tests one of those in Pearl Harbor. I'm not entirely sure what his method of thinking on this was, because he got a full warload Mark 18, a live one, set it up on a bench, set it running, and retreated behind a group of palm trees to see what would happen. You know, will the hydrogen build up to dangerous levels, etc.? And I was sort of going, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure a stand of palm trees will not withstand the blast of several hundred pounds of Torpex. But, you know, it's his decision. As it turns out, there is an explosion. The torpedo is blown in half, but luckily it's blown in half. It doesn't, you know, the warhead doesn't go off. It's just a sort of explosion of several dozen liters of hydrogen, and they have to improvise a solution to try and deal with this, which actually is basically the if you imagine a light bulb, a filament light bulb, but take the glass off, so as soon as you light it the element burns out, but then if you put enough voltage through it, you'll get arcing across the contacts. And he basically installs one of those over the batteries with the idea that it's electric anyway, so this will be powered by the batteries. And as it goes, as the hydrogen builds up, it will get burnt off in small quantities by the arcs, so it doesn't build up to dangerous levels. But this is the kind of, you know, jury-rigged repairs they're having to do to just get the thing even to function. And the Mark 18 goes on through the war to have a reputation of, you know, if it loses its depth control and pops up to the surface like it's done this time, that's probably the least of your worries, because as we'll subsequently find out, it also has a disturbing tendency to not go in the direction you wanted it to. And that can be anything from a few degrees off to deciding it's just going to just go around in circles at any given depth at any given time. Much like the Mark 14, they do eventually fix it, but it takes a while.
Yeah. And one of the jury rigged fixes for that hydrogen buildup is if the torpedo had been loaded in the torpedo tube for a period of time, they would actually backhaul it, pull it out of the torpedo tube to ventilate the battery. So periodically, here you are on a war footing, you got your torpedo tubes loaded, something causes a delay in firing, you've got to go and backhaul these torpedoes, ventilate the battery so the hydrogen doesn't explode. Man, oh man, huh? You know, aren't we making it?
Why don't we make it harder on yourself?
Exactly. Yeah.
So Tang is, you know, after this attack, you know, rather hair-raising, shall we say, Tang continues to wreak havoc in the Yellow Sea. At one time, you know, this, again, the aggressiveness, it sounds like, you know, a broken record, but it's the aggressiveness of O'Kane here. He actually grounds Tang. She actually, not intentionally, admittedly, but he does actually run just the slightest tip of her right there, just the tip on, you know, onto the surface there and or into the grounds her to make an attack in the very, very shallow waters of the Yellow Sea. And Drac, you were saying, you know, to your point about the depths of the Pacific, and the Pacific is obviously, there are certain areas, USS Indianapolis, that are incredibly deep, but the East China Sea, the Yellow Sea are notoriously shallow when it comes to submarine operations. And this is just one example of it. He gets the kill shot on this Japanese freighter. And, you know, he wants to stay in the Yellow Sea because of the target rich environment, but he also, and the crew, they want to get the hell out of there because there is no place to hide. If, God forbid, you do come under some sort of attack, there's really no place to hide. There's no place to run, you know, and we've said this before, that even though you are submerged sometimes in the water, from the air, you can still see that sucker.
Yeah. Paint, your paint job could save your life at that point.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But the problem is yellow sea is different. It's kind of a greenish color. It's generally 150 feet deep. And in fact, Chinese submarines, including their old SSNs, used to be painted green so they would be camouflaged better while submerged in the yellow sea.
Mm-hmm. You camouflage for your area of operations, I guess. As they say, you dress for the place you're going, not for the place you are. So on this patrol, Tang does something that is rather unique. It's not the only occurrence of this happening, but it's the only occurrence for Tang anyway. She captures a Japanese prisoner of war. This gentleman is named Mishitune Ka. He is dubbed Firecracker by the crew of USS Tang because they capture him on the 4th of July. You know, ironically, as compared to what would happen to O'Kane and, well, really any Allied prisoner of war, be the American, you know, Australian, British, whatever, they were treated extremely harshly, shall we say, by the Japanese. That's another episode for another day. But Tang's crew does not do that, do they? They treat this cat like he's royalty, really. Yeah. There's a story that O'Kane's making his rounds through the boat, walking through, and he sees, I forget the boat's cook. I can't remember what his name was. But he's in there and he's boiling rice and like just plain white rice. And O'Kane says, "What, you know, the hell are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, we're trying to get the texture of the rice just right for Firecracker because he, you know, apparently the rice we were making him before was a little too hard for him." So I mean, they're treating this guy like he's in a hotel, you know. And initially, when they capture this Japanese, you know, he, of course, he thinks he's in for, you know, immediate execution or torture or whatever. But, you know, after about a day or so, he realizes, you know, this isn't so bad. And there are pictures of this guy with crew members of the Tang. You know, of course, he's brought into Pearl Harbor and he's turned into to the agents, to the appropriate office there. But yeah, I mean, this is something that does not happen to Allied prisoners of war, shall we say. And in just another few short weeks, you know, Tang will find that out the hard way. She finishes her patrol. I said she turned her Mitsutune Ka to Pearl Harbor. They actually bring him to Midway. At the end of this patrol, O'Kane has and Tang have accounted for 10 ships sunk. This breaks Wahoo's record. At that time, it was the single highest patrol accomplishment. Bill, you had mentioned something about decorations for submarine crews and officers. You want to lay that on us? How this? So almost every successful patrol, a U.S. Navy submarine skipper is awarded a Navy Cross, which that is. How does that lay out?
Yeah. So early in the war, the Navy was actually pretty restrictive on the medals awarded, and while there were some skippers awarded medals, it was almost always posthumous. And while the military will deny it, there was an underlying attitude that these medals would entice the appropriately aggressive behavior. And if the medals were only awarded after somebody was killed in action, that's not rewarding appropriately aggressive behavior. People start to think that the only way I'm going to get a medal is to die. So right. They don't even think about it. So there is a standard established. You sink three ships, Silver Star, and I'm trying to go from memory here. Four ships, Navy Cross. You know, the Medal of Honor is actually not mentioned in that standard. It was decided that the Medal of Honor would be withheld for exceptionally meritorious gallant performance is the word that's used, gallant performance. And that determination as to whether or not a Medal of Honor would be recommended was withheld to Admiral Nimitz. That doesn't mean he could approve it. It means that he could recommend it.
Right.
So, you know, I think if the way there was also a flow down that it, that exists to this day, by the way, if the CO got a Navy cross, then generally two members of his crew, oftentimes the XO and the third officer, would get silver stars and so on and so forth. If the CO got a silver star, the flow down would be a Secretary of the Navy letter of commendation and so on. So, you know, by this point, I think that O'Kane had already received three Navy crosses, some during Wahoo's patrol, war patrol. I think one was awarded during one of Wahoo's patrols with Mush Morton, during which Mush got a Navy cross as well. But I think he received, but now again, these would be awarded time late. So you don't pull in from a patrol, Nimitz on the pier, pins a medal on you. Generally, two patrols or so later, it took for the medal to be approved. That's when you would receive it. So there was some time delay in all of that. It's generally how it went.
To your point, not to spoil the story, but I mean, come on, if you're listening to the show, you already know the story. O'Kane is awarded the Medal of Honor, three Navy crosses, three Silver Stars, the Legion of Merit with V device for valor, the Purple Heart, as well as many other decorations throughout his career. He's got to be, I mean, that's got to be
one of the
certainly
most,
not just sub skippers, but naval officers. I mean, good gravy.
And his Medal of Honor wasn't awarded to him until after the war had ended, and he'd been rescued.
From
POW camp. He's what I call an officer who, if he wears all his decorations, assumes a distinct list to port.
Very, very well put. But I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that's a lot of fruit salad. And you know, he didn't go out there to do that. That's not what he was out there to do, was, you know, be awarded medals.
And by the way, he stayed in the Navy for quite a bit of time after receiving all these medals. So it's not like, I must have done it, time to get out. He was promoted to captain. He commanded other ship, commanded submarine squadron in Pearl Harbor, submarine squadron 7. I commanded submarine squadron 3. So he stayed in for a while.
Yeah. He's if the viewer or listener sitting there going, man, God, they love this guy. Well, you know what? We do, because he's awesome. I mean, he was truly, he's one of my personal heroes. I never met the man, unfortunately, but he was an incredible human being. So after her third patrol, she goes out again on her fourth patrol. Her fourth patrol is successful in that she bags four more Japanese ships, but frankly, compared to her third patrol and what would be her fifth patrol, it's kind of anticlimactic. This is also, and this is important too, this is Frazee's final patrol as XO of Tang. He takes over as a skipper of a submarine, as most successful XOs do. But I am drawing a blank right now as to which one he does take over. Do either of you recall which boat he takes over, Frazee?
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah.
No, and in fact, I don't even think he makes a patrol before the war ends. And again,
as typical, skipper,
a skipper, right? A typical O'Kane. He goes to Lockwood and he says, "I'm embarrassed to say that my boat has a surplus of talent in the wardroom, and Braz ought to be a skipper today. He's been qualified for command for a year. He's made two patrols with me." After qualifying for command.
Oh,
he
made two more
after that. And so we're just wasting him. I've got other talent that can serve as exec. And so you really, really ought to let him go. Let him go to his own boat. And Lockwood agreed.
Yeah, and he did. I mean, you know, we're boomeranging and we're beating a horse, but Wahoo was the same way. And it's not just these two boats. I mean, be abundantly clear. I mean, there were a lot of other submarines in the fleet. You know, USS Drum had an abundance of talent. You know, there were Silver Sides, for crying out loud. You know, I mean, there were tons of submarine Barb, you know, good God, USS Barb, you know, there were a bunch of submarines that had a plethora of talent. This is why the U.S. submarine force was as effective as it was, is because you had these maverick skippers like O'Kane, like Morton, like Flucky, people like George Street, who bred these guys to carry on that tradition and to do their own. George Grider leaves Wahoo, becomes a skipper, you know? So, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it's this wealth of talent that is in the U.S. submarine Pacific floors. Okay. So let's get to the big one here. Tang goes out on her fifth patrol. This is her first time in this area, is known as the Formosa Straits. It's known that this is a hot area, quote unquote. That's what it was called by Pac Fleet. That's what Lockwood called it. That's what O'Kane called it. Says, hey, look, you're going to a hot area. This is likely to be a very, very target rich environment. Bill, you'd said something about Theodore Roscoe. What did he mention about Tang's performance in the Formosa Straits in 44?
Yeah, Formosa Strait bottleneck was rightly plugged at the northern end, and a single submarine served as cork. That submarine was Tang. Now, again, the Formosa Strait is very shallow. There are islands and shoals throughout that make it such that there are a few spots where you can penetrate into the Formosa Strait, now called the Taiwan Strait, of course. And it's in the news today with the tensions with China. Yeah. So it's an important area. It was one of the few areas that the Japanese still felt relatively invulnerable, that the submarines couldn't get to them. So the Japanese did run a lot of their shipping through the Formosa Strait because they thought it had a better survival rate to get to Japan. And so that's why it was a target-rich environment, but it was also a very dangerous environment, because it was within sight of shore. There were still operational airfields in Formosa that were, we'd go out and hunt for submarines. And of course the shipping density was fairly significant. So you had to watch out for those kinds of targets as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a hot area, to put it mildly. At this point, O'Kane, and it's not, it, this guy had been aboard the submarine for quite a while. He was a plank owner of Tang. He was a chief bosun's mate, which is an unusual rating to find aboard a submarine in World War II. Guy's name was Bill Leibold. Now, unlike you, Bill, I didn't know Richard O'Kane. I only wish I could have met him, but I did know retired commander Bill Leibold, who was aboard Tang for all of her patrols, including the fifth patrol. He started taking over as chief of the boat after Ballinger. O'Kane was kind of grooming him to take over this position, and Leibold was, let's just say, he was a strict disciplinarian, shall we say. Yeah.
He was the kind of chief who would take the sailors behind, behind a shack and straighten them out.
Yes.
physically straighten them out.
Yes, absolute big old boy too. I mean, just a big dude that was like, even when I knew him in his mid 90s, was built, like just solid as a rock. Let's just leave it at that. Mm-hmm. and leave it at that, at that range there. He was a big old boy, and the crew, mostly they all respected him to the nth degree, but mm-hmm. they knew that he was he was just as driven as O'Kane was. There were some guys that were up in the forward torpedo room who transferred successfully to the after torpedo room and then back to the forward torpedo room at one point later on, which actually saved their lives. They transferred out of that area just to get away from Leibold because he didn't have any authority on the back end of the boat. They used to call him, quote, that SOB. And Bill told me, he says, yeah, I was always, greatly appreciative of the fact that they used to call me that SOB, meaning sweet old Bill. Well, of course he knew exactly what they were talking about, but to his everlasting humor, he used to say that it meant sweet old Bill. There's a funny story. We've been talking about the efficiency and the coolness under fire of O'Kane and Tang and everything else, but it was a naval vessel. It was a U.S. Navy ship, and much like probably every U.S. Navy ship afloat, the sailors aboard Tang had some sort of secret still aboard Tang to produce alcohol. It was a known thing among the enlisted men and some of the officers that this still was aboard Tang, and it was in one of the bulkhead like lockers, basically. It was behind an AC condensing unit. It was well hidden, that if you didn't know it was there, you would never know it was there. And Leibold knew full well that it was there because he liked to partake from the from whatever that still
grape
produced.
Juice, right?
Exactly.
Welch's grape juice.
Well, there was a crewman aboard Tang, and I think it was Floyd Caverly. I could be wrong, or it might have been De Silva, but I'm pretty sure it was Caverly who had this uncanny knack to find and smuggle aboard fruit aboard Tang, like all kinds of fruit, you know, grapes and things like that, which were hard to get in the Pacific at that time for one reason or another. Regardless of this, everybody thought that O'Kane was completely unaware of the fact that this still was aboard the submarine. One day on the fifth patrol, as they're heading out towards the area, O'Kane is making his daily inspection of the submarine. He's basically walking up and down the length and breadth of the sub. When he notices, as he's walking past where the still is hidden inside the bulkhead of the submarine, there's this purple liquid flowing out from one of the seams on the locker, and it's flowing out all over the deck. And he's got Leibold with him, behind him. And he walks up and he looks down and he goes, "What in the hell is this?" And he just sees this purple juice flowing all over the place. And he turns around to Leibold, and they called him Boats because he was Boats and Mate. He says, "Boats, I don't know what this is, but figure it out and fix it right now." And Leibold, to his credit, he said, "I was terrified because I knew that if O'Kane found this, that was our ass. Like, he was going to probably get me off this boat. He was going to chew everybody that he could find on this boat."
Yeah.
And he just breezed past and he let it, you know, he forgot about it. Years after the fact, when I was interviewing Leibold, he said, you know, after when they were coming out of the prisoner of war camp, they were talking, they were heading back to the United States. And Leibold and O'Kane were just sitting there chatting one day aboard ship when they were heading back. And O'Kane brought it up and he said, "So, Bill, how was the booze?" And he said, Leibold, the color drained from his face. And he said, "I'm sorry, sir. What are you talking about?" He goes, "The still that was in the back end of my submarine. What? How was the booze?
Is it any good?" Yeah.
He said, at that moment right there, he says, "I knew O'Kane was the greatest human being to walk the earth, because he knew the entire time that that still was aboard his submarine. And he just let it go. He just let
it go." Yeah, you know, this, we called it torpedo juice. There was some, even when I was department head, my chief of the boat who joined the Navy, it was a chief petty officer the year I was born, still talked about when he made torpedo juice on submarines in the 1950s. That was the code word for illegal alcohol that was manufactured aboard the submarine. We called it torpedo juice.
Torpedo juice's history in the U.S. Navy is fascinating, because at the start of the war, you've got the basic fuel for the torpedoes is this pure, absolutely 100% pure grain alcohol. And people are like, "We can drink this." And as time goes on, you've got this escalating war where the Navy's like, "If we add this, like they know they can't add anything that's completely toxic because they'll end up killing half their sailors."
Yeah.
But they end up adding various compounds that they try to make it as unpalatable and as unpleasant an experience as possible, whilst not being fatal. And the U.S. sailors are just gradually going from just tapping torpedoes for the alcohol to, as you just described, like getting ever more inventive with various stills to try and distill the alcohol out of all the other stuff into it. I ran an experiment where I recreated torpedo juice. It's an interesting experience, to say the least. Yeah.
You made jungle juice out of torpedoes.
Well, this is the thing. For some bizarre reason, most manufacturers think it's irresponsible to sell 100% pure alcohol in a format that could be described as drinkable.
I wonder why.
Yeah, as it turns out, I could only find two places on the planet that would actually do it. One of which is actually in the US. I think it's called Everclear.
Yes.
And
I'm all too familiar with Everclear.
Importing that into the UK is a little difficult. So I found the only other people crazy enough to sell pure alcohol in drinkable format, which is the Polish. So imported a bottle of it from Poland and carefully followed the traditional Navy mixture of two parts alcohol to three parts insert citrus juice of choice. Because, of course, they're not going to have much of an option. It's like whatever you can get your hands on. But yeah, that's the first time I've experienced gradual loss of feeling, starting at the extremities and working its way along.
Well, clearly you've never had mountain moonshine, which I have, but it'll do the same thing. So you could use it in your lawnmower to start your mower. But
yeah,
we're I we digress here.
We do.
But it's an important part, though, you know?
Yeah, it's germane because O'Kane injures himself at the beginning of this patrol.
Yes.
By falling down at like 3 to 4 feet down a hatch, mm-hmm. and lands on his foot, breaking it. And of course, the pharmacist mates are superb. We call them independent duty corpsmen on submarines. And, you know, they take care of him. But he could have used some of that torpedo juice after he broke his foot.
I would imagine he would have liked to have had some. Yeah. And, you know, he hobbles around. And, you know, to your point, I think it was Larson. They called him Doc Larson, was the pharmacist mm-hmm. mate aboard Tang. You know, O'Kane's foot had done one of these numbers. He'd broken several bones in his feet. And Larson basically grabs his foot and snaps that sucker back into place, which I'm sure O'Kane, you know, loved the way that felt.
And he said, I've done everything for you. They would do you ashore, except maybe they'd do an X-ray.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing more that they would do. So I think you're good to go.
Yeah. So except for the pain. Yeah. He puts on his boondockers and basically just laces them up so damn tight, you know, that he basically can't feel his foot anymore, although he feels it every single time he moves. He starts walking around on his heels, which, you know, to alleviate the pain so much as that is. But, you know, it's setting up to be kind of an odd patrol for Tang, but you know, with the, you know, the skipper falling through the hatch and everything else, it's just kind of an eerie, ominous beginning, if you will, if you believe that sort of thing. On October 10th, it brings the first target for Tang. Two fish are sent into the Joshu Maru. She winds up sinking this vessel here. The following day, Tang runs into another Japanese freighter, sends her down too. So he's actually, you know, he's doing what he's out there to do. He's sinking ships. The thing is he remarked about this after the fact, is that the Japanese clearly had no indication that there was an American submarine in the area. It wasn't until after the second ship that he sunk went down, and I'm talking like within a couple of hours, he sends both these things down, boom, boom, that the Japanese start going, something ain't right here. Because they, post-war, they attributed the first ship that Tang sunk on this patrol to be, it was hit by a mine, or that it ran into a mine, rather. So they think, it happens. So we'll chalk that up to, you know, just bad luck. And then, of course, blam, the second one goes down. And at that point, the Japanese are like, maybe we might have, you know, a rotten apple in the bunch out there. Something might be going on. You know, we got a snake in the hen house here. On October 22nd, 1944, this is one of the more exciting attacks ever conducted by an American submarine of the war. And this isn't even the final attack. Tang encounters a convoy. As the targets come into visual range, O'Kane noted that the majority of the ships were riding low, meaning they were heavily loaded. And Bill, from your experience, you can tell pretty quick whether a ship is loaded or not. I mean, just from, right?
Yeah, how deep they're riding, absolutely.
Yeah. So O'Kane plots a course to take Tang inside the escort for another night surface attack. Again, you know, ringing true to his tried and true tactics. In a short time, Tang had gotten inside the convoy on the surface and was maneuvering with the convoy. As the convoy is zigging and zagging and making, of course, Tang is basically, he's just shadowing. He's like a shark coming after these targets. He's doing whatever they do. He's moving right with them. They have no...
Yeah, he's thinking if they have radar that they're going to think he's in their formation and not suspect. But he didn't know if anybody had radar.
I don't know. Some of them did, but I'm not sure if it was this convoy or the next. Because once he does get into, I think it's the next convoy, and we're getting ahead of the story. We'll get to that in a minute. But regardless of this, on the surface again, he fires at two targets at once. This is, again, back to what he'd done on the third patrol. He wanted to create so much confusion so as to allow him to escape. As O'Kane was looking into the TBT topside, this is the binoculars that we had talked about, Bill, that you set up for us. Yeah, on the bridge. He did not notice that he had actually been spotted by one of the transports. Now, again, you know, it's a nighttime surface attack. Sooner or later, your luck is going to run out and they're going to see you at some point. That's exactly what happens here. And one of the rare instances where O'Kane was not fully cognizant of his entire surroundings, he sort of had target fixation. He was looking through the TBT, lining up his next target when Chief Leibold, the gentleman I was talking about before, Boats, who was one of the topside lookouts, grabbed O'Kane by the shoulder and pulled him. He told me, he says, I pulled him so hard, I actually jerked him off of his feet. You know, he wasn't actually trying to obviously injure the skipper who was already hurt, but he grabbed him because he wanted to get his attention. And he says, the only way I could get his attention was to physically lay hands on him. And O'Kane said later, he says, Leibold grabbed him and pulled him so hard, he thought he dislocated his shoulder. Well, the reason that he was trying to get his attention is because there was a Japanese transport coming in to ram the Tang. This thing is coming close. At this point, O'Kane turns around, screams, you know, flank and all ahead emergency, and gets Tang to pour on the coal. He's trying to get out of the way as fast as he can. And he was so close. The submarine was so close to the Japanese that when it passed the submarine, rifle fire erupted from the Japanese transport and the rounds were ricocheting off of Tang's superstructure. The Japanese were pointing down towards Tang. That's how close they were with their rifles that they could actually shoot at the submarine with rifle fire. Gentlemen, think about that for a minute. I mean, that is,
that is one of those situations where you got to open if you want to attack them with the torpedoes to get sufficient range for the torpedoes to arm. Now, the other thing I want to set up with this is, and this approach is, if my memory serves correctly, Tang is seaward of the convoy. Now, that the shore is visible, and there are lights ashore, and it's a very difficult task at night to pick out targets against a dark landmass. And occasionally you can see the target pass in front of a light and the light's occluded, and that's one way you know that. But this is a really, the description doesn't set up how difficult an approach and attack O'Kane had in this situation, because he's shooting in the dark against dark targets against dark land, and he's hoping that since he's seaward that they're not going to be able to see him as easily. That they're going to have as much difficulty seeing him as he has to see them.
Yeah. And it's kind of what happens here. And that, you know, the transport passes so close, we said they take rifle fire, but as the transport's passing Tang, she actually begins to run into another Japanese ship within the convoy. And as Tang is pulling away, to your point, Bill, trying to clear the area, she fires from her stern, hits these two vessels at the same time, almost simultaneously. And that last detonation actually made the escorts, who by now, I mean, you got to imagine this has got to be absolute chaos inside of here. The escorts are actually shooting at one another. They don't know what the hell's going on.
But yeah, they've got friendlies in the line of fire.
Yeah, it's a zoo. It's the 4th of July in there, right there. In one short, furious attack, Tang sends four Japanese ships to the bottom. That made six for the patrol so far. Not to be outdone. 2 days later, October 24th, 1944, Tang begins patrolling at periscope depth, where she picks up another large convoy. The sound man, who was Floyd Caverly, says, we got another convoy, Captain. And this is two convoys in, you know, 2.5 days that they run across. As Tang pulls in, it's another night surface attack. As Tang pulls into position at this point, this is when theoretically one of the Japanese ships, somebody had some sort of radar detection device, because they do pick up Tang, don't they, Bill?
Yeah. So one thing I want to set up before that, Seth, is that every maritime nation has these things called navigational aids, which are generally lights that flash at night, so you can, in particular in restricted waters, so you know which way is safe and which way is not safe. But during wartime, frequently nations will shut those navigation aids off, because by the pattern of their blinking, you could tell precisely where that navigation aid is based on the chart. In this case, a navigation aid came on, and it was an occluded light, which means the light's on most of the time, then blinks off for a short period of time, then it's on, blinks off. It was remarkable to O'Kane that his navigation aid was lit. And he's thinking, the only reason they would turn this on is if somebody is coming and needs to navigate. And the Japanese had, by this time, I think they knew, they definitely knew there was a submarine in the area. So these ships were trying to hug the coastline to try to stay away from the submarine that they knew was out there somewhere and turn the navigation aid on so that these ships would not run aground. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the situation. O'Kane had figured this all out. He sussed it out. Mm-hmm. They're going to be very far inland, inshore, and I'm going to have to go after them into shoal water if I'm going to get them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he sets up his approach that way.
And true to form, you know, he does the same thing as tried and true tactic. He tries to get inside the Japanese convoy and or he doesn't try. He does get inside the Japanese convoy, inside the escort barrier, mm-hmm. and just starts shooting. He starts shooting torpedoes everywhere. As the torpedoes start to hit, you know, typical as to what happened a couple of nights before, the escorts start shooting at anything and everything they can see, which is not Tang. At one point or another, an escort actually does start to draw a bead on Tang, and some of the rounds do start to get a little too close to the point where O'Kane says, nope, we're out of here. And he turns the coal, he pours the coal on for Tang and tries to beat feet and get out of there, pull out of the convoy. Now, Bill or Drac, maybe you can explain this. At some point, you know, when they're pouring on the coal, when they're going wide open, those diesels do emit smoke. Yeah. They do emit exhaust, yes?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, well, it's you can also, if you're really unlucky, get sparks. Mm-hmm. It depends. I mean, a lot of it depends on how much oxygen is getting into the engines. Are you, if you put like proper pedal to the metal, you might be flooding some of the cylinders with a bit too much fuel for what can combust at any given point. And the other thing is, if you've been out for a while, you can also get accretions of soot and other partially burnt fuel actually in the stacks or funnels, whatever you want to call them, the exhausts. And if all of a sudden you're going all out, you can end up with chunks of that getting blasted loose or catching fire as well. Mm-hmm. It's mostly fairly brief, unless you're a tramp steamer that's been toodling along without a proper clean for decades, you're not going to be belching smoke and flame for hours and hours and hours. But in those opening moments where you've gone like 0 to 60 in 5 seconds, if someone's got a sharp lookout, they'll be like, oh, there seems to be a column of sparks going that way. Or if it's a very well-lit night, they might notice a haze of thick smoke that they can then track and go, something is producing this. No. There are measures on the subs to try and reduce that, because more so than on regular warships. But it's a reducer. It's not a complete eliminator.
Right. And that's apparently what happens here is that, you know, O'Kane, they open the throttle up so damn wide that she does belch out some smoke. Mm. And that does draw even more Japanese fire to them in such a way that Tang has to, you know, zig and zag. And she's trying to get out of there because the Japanese, they're starting to get they're walking their fire into where they presume the enemy submarine to be. And they are getting closer and closer to it. So to it being Tang, of course, that smoke does dissipate. And I mean, you know, that had to be frustrating for the Japanese gunners thinking, oh, we're getting there. And then boom, it's gone. And then it's gone. And as Tang's pulling away, she fires her stern tubes, typical tactic by O'Kane, hitting those targets as well. So, you know, this is about this and the night before where, you know, the Japanese are shooting rifles at the crewmen aboard Tang is about as close as it gets for any submarine in the war that I can recall personally. Bill, you might know different. Drac, you may know different. But, I mean, that's damn close, you know,
there are a few closer encounters, but they're not usually ones that the submarine walks away from.
Right.
You know, there's various U-boats. There was one famous incident where a U.S. ship is so close in their fight with a U-boat that they're actually throwing potatoes and tins of food at the crew because the escort is so small that they realize if the submarine crew get to the deck gun, that deck gun could actually sink them. And at that point, I think the suppressing fire from the small automatic weapons is they're out of ammo. They're looking for reloads, and the guns can't depress because they're so close, you know, 20 mils and so forth. So they're literally just throwing anything solid at the to try and knock people over the side of their own sub. Yeah, and there's a few instances where you get some really, really crazy, what we would call corvette actions. I guess in the US Navy, they're early destroyer escorts. Well, they're not even destroyer escorts because they're not even that shape. They're like a flower class corvette, that kind of thing. So 800-900 tons. There's a couple of New Zealand ships in the Guadalcanal campaign that end up taking on a Japanese sub that I think, if I remember correctly, actually has a submerged displacement that's greater than both of the New Zealand escorts combined. Mm-hmm. And they end up ramming it repeatedly in an attempt again to stop it getting its deck gun into action. But in all of those cases, the sub doesn't actually make it, because once you get that to that close range, even rifle fire can quite often put holes in the pressure hull. And if that happens, then the submarine can't really dive. If it can't dive, it's inevitably going to be a matter of time before somebody shoots it or rams it. Which, again, to be fair, actually, you know, looping back to what we said really early at the beginning about the Balao having the thicker hull, she probably didn't suffer any perforations of her pressure hull, because that was just about thick enough to repel even close range rifle fire.
Mm-hmm. And the 7.7 Japanese 7.7 is not exactly the strongest rifle in the world either.
That no.
So, you know, typical of O'Kane, he's not done after they, you know, go in there and just create this absolute chaotic melee inside of this convoy. He damages one ship. He sinks, what did I say, four? Five. I forget exactly what it was in that first initial attack, but he damages one ship, and he's got two torpedoes left. He decides, he's like, well, I'm not bringing these damn things home. Let's get rid of these two torpedoes. And let's finish off this target. Let's finish off this target. Let's peel away, reload. Everybody take a head break, you know, grab you a cup of coffee. We'll finish these guys and we're out of here. And that's exactly what he does. He O'Kane brings Tang away from the convoy. The convoy, what's left of it, does go off, and he brings the submarine back to one of the damaged vessels and has both torpedoes, last two torpedoes, loaded and double checked.
Still on the surface.
Brings her up close. I forget what the range. It was about 1,000 yards away, and fires. He fires this one torpedo, the second to last torpedo. Runs hot, straight, and normal. The first fish hits as the second torpedo leaves the tube. It's the last torpedo. And I want to put this into perspective. So Richard O'Kane had been aboard Wahoo for five patrols. Was it five total? Yeah, because Wahoo made six patrols. So he was aboard for five patrols. This is his fifth patrol aboard Tang. So it's his 10th war patrol. And then, too, he'd been aboard Argonaut, too. So, I mean, the dude had a lot of service underwater. He was not stupid in that he knew that more than likely this was going to be, and Leibold confirmed this, that, you know, O'Kane said, this is my last patrol. You know, much Morton on his sixth patrol, this is probably it. They're going to probably make me, you know, pilot a desk after this. So he was aware that this was probably his last ride aboard Tang. Not that that brings any... Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't mean anything, but he also knew that this was, you know, this is it. This is probably
he was a commander at this point, which is unusual for submarine COs. He'd been project commander.
Yeah, he was going to be rotated to the States and teach other guys how to kill Japanese ships. Last torpedo that he fires in his career is what's called an erratic fish. This thing leaves the torpedo tube, and within seconds of it leaving the tube, it breaks the surface and makes a sharp turn to the left. Leibold, who's on the bridge at that moment, screams as loud as he can. He just says, quote, "There goes that one, erratic, a circular run." O'Kane, you know, hears this, immediately looks, sees this thing porpoising. It's putting off that phosphorescent wake, and it is making a boomerang right back towards USS Tang. O'Kane hollers down as loud and as fast as he can, which, by the way, he was not a yeller. You know, he was a very calm, cool, and collected individual. He didn't yell any orders. And that's from the survivors when they heard this, when they heard O'Kane scream, "All ahead emergency," they knew something ain't right. Something's wrong. And of course, the guys below have no clue what the hell is going on. This torpedo is making a beeline right for Tang. He's pouring on the throttle as much as he can and swerving the stern of Tang away from the track of the torpedo. And he almost makes it. That's the heartbreaking part of it, is that if you look at the damage, the assumed damage report after the fact, which I'll show in this video, he almost makes it. I mean, it's just a few, you know, maybe 20 feet, 30 feet, and which for a submarine is not a lot. Yeah. And he's going to make it. Unfortunately, that it doesn't happen. The torpedo slams into the after part of the port section of the submarine, absolutely destroying her propulsion, killing everybody in the after torpedo room. And instantly Tang loses way and just go boom and goes down by the stern. Her stern hits bottom. They're only in 180 foot of water here. Her bow is kind of sticking up out of the water, like this, you know, it's like a 45 degree angle or something like that.
Everybody O'Kane, on the bridge immediately goes overboard.
Yeah. Including O'Kane. They're all washed overboard. It's what, 8-9 guys on the bridge party are washed overboard, I believe.
It's 8 or 9. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. O'Kane treads water for, you know, he thinks it was about 7 hours, with broken foot and all. He finds and hangs onto a portion of a floating door from one of the victims of, you know, Tang's many victims that night. Mm-hmm. Other survivors, Bill Leibold, Floyd Caverly, they find one another and they hang onto each other and float in the water. They stayed together the entire night once they found one another, which was relatively quickly. Leibold said later that he could hear two other crewmen who were part of the bridge watch try to swim away towards the China coast. They can see China. That's how close they are. They can actually see the coast of China. They estimated what, Bill, about 20 miles track, maybe 20 miles.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, your horizon is 15 to 20 miles on a good day. Mm-hmm. If you're at surface level. Mm-hmm. And that area of the Chinese coast isn't too hilly. So it's not going to be like, oh, I can see a mountain.
Either way, they're close, and these guys feel like they can swim to shore. They try to do that. They're never seen again.
Well, the current's in that strait, you ain't swimming far. You're just going to be swept north or south, depending on which current you end up running into first.
And that's what happens to a lot of these guys. You know, they feel like they can swim to land and they get out maybe 20, 30 yards and they realize, oh, this ain't happening. And the current winds up bringing them back. And I say a lot of guys, because there were actually more than just the 9 that were swept overboard from the bridge. One in particular is one of the officers, Larry Savadkin. He escapes Tang by a free ascent, which that's
out of
not
the conning. Yeah, conning tower.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's one of two survivors. He's one of two survivors from the conning tower. He's the only one that makes it to the surface. There was another, an enlisted man with him, and God bless him, I cannot remember his name right now off the top of my head, that tried to do the free ascent with him and grabs onto Savadkin's legs. And at one point, Savadkin said that he just felt the sailor let go and like literally physically felt him let go of his feet. And Savadkin, he surfaces about 60 foot of water, and he's blowing, literally blow and go. He's blowing, he's exhaling as he's rising to the surface. He later said that as he felt his lungs about to explode because he needed water, boom, he pops to the surface.
And by the way, we practiced an escape from about that depth. And you have to blow out. You know, in his case, he wasn't pressurized when he began, but you have to exhale the entire way or you suffer from an air embolism, which he was in danger of. Can't hold your breath is the bottom line. You have to exhale as you're ascending.
That had to be terrifying. But I mean, you don't have a choice. Absolutely. You know, what are your choices? Yeah. It's either die this way or die that way. And let me at least try and survive, you know? So he winds up popping to the surface. He makes water wings out of his pants, you know, which is something that they, you know, Bill is an old Eagle Scout. Yeah, you learn that in Scouts. Hell, I remember that in Boy Scouts. Yeah. You made water wings out of your pants. You know, and that's what he does, and that's how it keeps him afloat. Mm-hmm. beneath the, but that's not the most amazing part. And beneath the surface, there's an estimated 30 survivors aboard Tang, and they're all now concentrated up towards the forward torpedo room. And remember, as I said, her bow is sticking up at about, I don't know, 45, 50 degree angle, just popping out of the water. Well, you know, the natural thought is, well, why can't they climb out the torpedo tubes or something like that? You know, it doesn't work like that, does it, Bill?
No, it doesn't. And of course, at this point, the bow had already started settling because the compartments are flooding from the stern forward, and people are escaping forward as they can, trying to shut the hatches. I don't remember. I think they were not able to shut the hatch between the engine room and the, you know, we call it the middle compartment, because the water flooding in was rushing too fast. So that one remained open, and they went forward further into the forward torpedo room, and they were able to get that hatch shut. But in the meantime, the water intruding in the battery causes a battery fire. So they're having to deal with this battery fire, unable to put that out. So that's consuming air. They know that they don't have a lot of time. If they're going to make an escape, they've got to make it quickly.
Yeah. And it's, and the, top that, you know, they got to make it quickly. A lot of these guys are wounded. You know, they're all scared. You know, I don't care who you are. You know, you're making pearls in your drawers right now. I mean, you are terrified at this point. The only way to escape was to use the escape hatch. And the only way to do that is to level the submarine. And the only way to level the submarine is to sink it, which is exactly what they do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Clay Decker, one of the survivors, basically hand over hand finds the lever to flood the forward ballast tanks. And that's exactly what happens. Tang's bow just boom beneath the surface. At this point, over the next several hours, a total of 13 men, it's believed to be 13 anyway, do escape Tang using the forward escape hatch and the Momsen lung. There's a couple of guys who, and there is one guy who actually escapes the sunken submarine. I cannot remember. I think it's Hayes Truckee. Does the blow and go technique. He doesn't use a Momsen lung, or if he had one, he loses it. I don't remember anymore, frankly, but he gets up to the surface without using the Momsen lung by the, you know, skin of his teeth. The survivors.
Ironically, Swede Momsen, inventor of the Momsen lung, was the squadron training officer when Tang left Pearl Harbor the last time. So, you know, these guys are being rescued to the extent they were, by a device that was invented by the guy who's back in Pearl Harbor as a training officer.
And, you know, the question has always been that I've been asked is, why didn't more people get out? Well, there's a multitude of reasons. As I said, you know, a lot of them were wounded. These, you know, not everyone was scot-free. And as we'll see, there's a couple of guys that do pop to the surface that either are wounded or become wounded by popping to the surface. These guys are all, as I said, terrified. The Momsen lung was something that, to your point, Bill, was a relatively new thing to guys. They a lot of them had not been, even though they were supposed to have been trained with it, a lot of guys didn't want to use it. They didn't put a lot of faith into it. They figured, Christ, if I ever have to use this, I'm dead anyway. So the vast majority of guys, A, didn't know how to use it, B, didn't want to use it, and C, I don't think there were enough to use for the entire crew anyway. I sincerely doubt they had 90 of them aboard.
And even if they did, they're not necessarily going to be all in the forward torpedo room.
Exactly.
That's right.
So
even when I was serving, we had devices that we said, this is to make mommy feel good. This isn't actually going to do anything to save my life, but we have them to make the family feel better.
It works, because there are guys that get to the surface using the Momsen lung. As I said, there's a total of about 13 that they think got to the surface. Six of the escapees that use the escape hatch from the sunken submarine survive. It is assumed that the other guys who came to the surface either lost the lungs going up, or they got the bends when they got to the surface.
Paramilism.
The guys that survive are Jesse Da Silva, Hayes Truckee, Hank Flanagan, Pete Narawanski, and Clay Decker. These are the guys that escaped the sunken submarine. Doc Larson, the man who fixed Skipper's foot, does get to the surface, but he's coughing up blood. It's assumed that he
is embolized.
He burst a lung coming up. It is also thought that one of the steward's mates, who was one of O'Kane's favorite people on the planet, was a guy named Howard Walker, African-American steward's mate. He also makes it to the surface as well, but he also probably dies of the bends, because they do see it's, I mean, can't remember, it's dark, and they see a gentleman pop to the surface. They recognize the voice that it probably is Howard Walker, and he's screaming and thrashing, and then he sinks and he disappears. So more than likely, he also died from the bends. It's a horrible way to end the story, but that's kind of how the story ends to a point. You know, there's a lot more to it that we're gonna save for another episode, but you know, the Japanese come in the morning as the sun rises, and they start plucking the survivors of Tang out of the water, all of them, including Doc Larson, who the Japanese rolled overboard of a raft because they realized that either A, he was dead, or B, he was dying, that there was no saving him. They just roll him over and push him into the ocean. All of the men, including O'Kane, are rescued by a Japanese patrol craft, and they're thrown on the deck, literally thrown on the deck, the steel deck of the ship. And they're surrounded by the victims of their sinkings from the night before. They beat the ever-loving crap out of them. Yeah. And once the Japanese realize who these people are that are sitting on the deck of their ship, is you can imagine that the treatment that the survivors from Tang received was, shall we say, less than pleasant, and certainly was not the treatment that the Japanese prisoner of war, Mitsutuni Ka, that was rescued by Tang, received. Cigarette butts are put out on their face, up their nose. You know, they're beaten with clubs, they're kicked, they're punched, they're pounded. They're denied the basic, you know, existence, you know, of food and water. They are given some water and like rice balls later, like the following day. They're put on this hot steel deck, and their hands and feet are tied in the sun, so they're, you know, getting cooked by the sun. It's a harbinger of things to come for the prisoners of war at the hands of the Japanese, who are and were crew members of Tang.
There was a brief moment of hope, though, because they were transferred to a patrol craft, and the captain of the patrol craft spoke English, brought O'Kane to his stateroom, let him stay there, fed him, and wanted to discuss in English Margaret Mitchell's great Civil War novel. And, you know, O'Kane thought, well, maybe this isn't going to go so bad. But as soon as they were transferred off of that patrol craft onto shore, the beatings began again. Rest of his existence and their existence was miserable. Too much to go into. This episode's already gone too long. But you could read about it.
Yeah, and we will do an episode on the prisoners of war of the Japanese at some point. We'll focus on these guys again. But at this point, you know, her career is over. O'Kane's submarine skipper career is over as well. Tang is credited with being the most successful United States submarine in history. Her final fifth patrol credits Tang with 13 ships sunk. And hold on before everybody goes, no, it's less than that. Just hang loose, mother goose. JNAC, which stands for Joint Army Navy Assessment Committee. I know all of us, and I know you too, Jack Track, have run into this JNAC report before. Briefly, JNAC, it discredited a lot of submarine claims by American skippers during the war, or after the war, rather, I should say. Like, significantly, did it not?
Yeah, that it's there's two elements to it, one of which is especially with the early war stuff, when you have a lot of premature torpedoes and so forth, and people, again, early war, they're using the pre-war US Navy tactics of launching from below, whereas obviously we've seen with Tang, she prefers to launch from the surface. So when you're launching from below, if you fire a bunch of torpedoes at targets in the open ocean and you hear an explosion, you're going to assume that that's a hit.
Right.
Yeah, it turns out that there are sometimes there have been attacks where the submarine, in all good faith, is like, well, we have fired four torpedoes, we heard three explosions, none of those freighters were greater than 8,000 tons. There's no way an 8,000 ton freighter is living through three torpedo hits. We're going to claim that as sunk, but it was like three prematures or something like that. And they can prove, actually, no, this is the convoy, these are the ships, none of them were actually sunk, so they have to knock those off. You also have various claims that are reduced, where, you know, the skipper said, well, according to our ID charts, we think this was a 12,000 ton freighter, but it turns out it's a 6,000 ton freighter. So that doesn't reduce the number of ships destroyed, but it does reduce their overall tonnage. There's a whole thing with Albacore that goes on, because for a long time, JNAC refuses to acknowledge that Shinano actually exists. Mm-hmm. And they have to invent another Hio class out of thin air to explain what happened.
Overall,
they're trying to do this, you know, they're trying to reduce overclaiming. It's the same thing you see with the air war, you know, where both sides have claimed to have shot down everybody else's production of aircraft three times over. But it does go a little bit too far sometimes, not helped by the fact that, unlike in the European side of things, you're having to translate over records from Japanese, and they're partial records from Japanese.
Right.
And especially with early war, late war stuff, there's also the case of, okay, the Japanese aren't building huge numbers of new ships, but they are building some, and they do recycle names as well. Mm-hmm. So there are occasionally times where they're like, you know, you might have a specific Japanese ship and you're like, oh yeah, well, you know, this submarine claimed to sink it in 1943, but it's floating here in Tokyo Harbor in 1946. But then subsequent to that, you know, years right. later, like, well, actually, no, that was sunk in 1943. This is one they built in 1944 as a replacement. Just happens to have the same name. But how do you, you know, when the Japanese set fire to half their records in the at the end of World War II, trying to prove any of this takes a while.
Yeah.
So the overall truth of, you know, exactly what was sunk ends up being halfway between the what the subs are claiming and what JNAC says. JNAC is too conservative.
Mm-hmm. And to that end, in 1989, the United States Navy reverted submarine claims back to the World War II skipper claims upon reexamination and the availability of new records that were previously unavailable at the time the JNAC committee was operating. Because of this, Tang is credited with a total of 33 or 36, depending on how you want to look at it, ships sunk. Highest tonnage of any submarine in the Pacific War. Dick O'Kane, if you think about the numbers, so Wahoo sank 20 ships. Two of those were sunk by Kennedy. And I believe the final four or five were sunk by Morton once O'Kane was gone from Wahoo. But do the math. The 36, 33, however you want to look at it, sunk by Tang. And then those that O'Kane was sinking, essentially, while manning the scope aboard Wahoo, makes him easily the deadliest submarine skipper the United States ever produced. And the deadliest man on a periscope to ever claim lineage to the United States of America. You know, I mean, he was a bad, bad man. Just a bad man. Bill, let's wrap this up. You have a quote from O'Kane that I know means something to you.
I used to, when I was CEO of a submarine, I would, I brought some Army guys aboard every now and then to show them what being on a submarine's like. And I would get a little snarky at times. And I would say, you know, when you ground pounders go on a patrol, this is pre-9/11, the ground isn't trying to kill you. The enemy's trying to kill you, but the ground isn't trying to kill you. But we submariners, every time we go to sea, the sea is trying to kill us. So our first job is to not allow the sea to kill us. And then we can fight our war. And I derived this from one of Richard O'Kane's statements, where he said, we are, after all, mariners first and submariners second, with a continuing love for all ships and the sea. And I would say, and a respect for the sea. And I'm reminded of Nimitz's quote about, you know, mariners having to be cautious. Millennia of going to sea has proven that's the right approach. And in fact, I used O'Kane's quote when I was XO of a submarine, and I led a study to understand why submarines were having, we'll call them incidents. And what had occurred to us during this study was that we had combined mariner training with combat training as if they were the same thing, but they're very, very different. Mariner training is almost the opposite of combat training. And it's something that O'Kane understood, something that I leveraged during the submarine study. and, you know, said we got to train people how to be mariners first, and then train them how to fight the submarine. And I think that policy is in place even today. And started with this quote that I'd read from Richard O'Kane back in the 1970s.
Yeah, that's a. I think that's a absolutely perfect way to wrap it up. Drac, do you have anything else you want to throw in before we sign off on this one?
Well, I think the only other thing I would throw in is that people should bear in mind Tang was only in service for about a year, commissioned to sinking, and of that, the first few months are shakedown and getting out to Pearl. So her actual operational career only spans a portion of 1944, and she's able to accomplish everything that she does within that very, very narrow window of time. So, you know, who knows what she would have gone on to do in the last part of 44 and 45 if that Mark 18 hadn't decided to circle back.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I mean, her first patrol's in January, you know, 44, and this one's, you know, what did I say, was October? So I mean, that's October 24th is when she goes down. I mean, that's not a long life, man. That's, you know, 9.5 months, really, you know, to be close. And I mean, you know, in all likelihood, this was, regardless of what happened, this was O'Kane's last patrol, probably. So she would have more than likely had a new skipper, but that crew, the core, would have been there. And God knows, you know, God knows, but that is not what happened. But still in all, she is the most successful American submarine of the war. She is captained by the most, the deadliest American submariner in history. And her name is legend, was then and still is today. So with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and a review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. If you have a question or comment, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. I should also add, and I know that the vast majority of you watching this are already subscribed to Drac's YouTube channel, but if you aren't, do so. It is a wealth of information. It's high quality, high class material. I enjoy watching it on my lunch break when I'm not recording these podcasts. And I'm doing it from my house today, regardless. But it's a wealth of information. And Drac, we greatly appreciate you being on board with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Drac, we get a lot of comments along the lines of, we like your discussion, but we want more maps and videos. Nice. And to which I normally respond, yeah, that's Drac. Go see Drac. Because Drac and Bill have all of those things. You know, we're the guys who just kind of, you know, shoot the breeze. That's our niche. And so we do try to refer people to you as if you need it anymore, right?
Well, every little helps.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Well, once again, my name is Seth Paradin. I want to thank you for listening and or watching. Bill?
I'm Bill Todi. Drac, really thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yep.
Likewise.
And we will see you guys next week.